Call the meeting order, and I think we almost have a quorum. Sam Haas, are you? Boss, oh, okay. I'll change the agenda. Representative Dill has some constituents that came all the way from the North Shore, so we'll let Representative Dill get up there first. And do I have a quorum? I think I need one more for a quorum. So Representative Dill, why don't you go ahead and present your bill, and we'll move it when we get the meeting going here. Welcome to the committee, Representative Dill. We now have a quorum. So Representative Detmer moves that House Law 2629 be recommended to pass, and
Mr. Chair, excuse me. 3602, Mr.
I represent Bill, or Detmer moves also 3602 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion. I think there's a, well, Representative Dale, did you expect this bill to travel on its own?
I was hoping so.
However,
you'd like to handle it, Mr. Chair.
Why don't we look at it first, and we'll make the correct motion as far as moving it to the General Register if we can. Okay. Go ahead.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is about business subsidies and the basically the requirement to have a public hearing. And as you know, this was enacted many years ago, the 25,000, and it is getting more and more cumbersome. Business subsidies that are occurring in communities, whether they be Job Z or TIF or loans or grants, they're climbing. They have climbed dramatically over the years, Mr. Chair. And so each and every one of those requires the variety of different public notices and public hearings. And so with me today, I have Connie Christensen with me today to explain some of the nuances of the bill. So,
welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And you can identify yourself for the committee.
My name is Connie Christensen, and I am here as a representative of the Economic Development Association of Minnesota. I have served on the EDAM Board of Directors for the last 4 years, and I am employed as an economic development representative for St. Louis County and have been for the last 12 years. I am here in support of the proposed language change to Section 1, Subdivision 3 of Minnesota Statute 116J993, and Section 2, Subdivision 5 of 116J994, which intends to raise the threshold for all three sections to $200,000. However, we want to make clear the requirement that we set wage goals will still apply to the lower levels provided in the original subsidy legislation. As a member of two statewide economic development organizations, EDAM and the Minnesota Association of Professional Economic Developers, which is also known as MAPFED, as well as the Regional Association of the Iron Range Economic Alliance, I am aware of the issues and concerns of my fellow economic developers. This business subsidy has risen as a top concern statewide. The intent of the business subsidy legislation was to provide a structured process and mechanism for ensuring the creation of good quality jobs when public funds are invested, with accountability for non-performance. Arguably, this legislation has set the bar higher for economic development activities. More focus is given to the deals that will bring the greatest aggregate benefit to the community, either through higher wage deals, attracting high-wage industries, or a strategic approach to community development. I believe there has been tremendous improvement in local decision-making through formalized business subsidy policies and criteria. There is no dispute on the benefits of public disclosure of business assistance. I support policy that raises overall community economic health through the assistance of business growth and expansion. But the downside has been in the time delays, the regulatory burden, and smaller public investment. Early support by resolutions came in from around the state. We have resolutions from the Port Authority in Winona, Duluth, Eagan, MAPFED, which their policy was rolled over into the AMC, the Association of Minnesota Counties legislation, the Iron Range Economic Alliance, Cloquet, and Carlton County. Some of the key concerns with the current legislation as they outlined in those resolutions were, one, businesses have more costly equipment and technology today. We track business assistance, including jobs and dollars leverage. We believe accountability is best measured at the local level. Another comment, I haven't had any deals fall through because of it, but it certainly adds legal and other fees without adding any value to the transaction. Another comment, any reduction in paperwork associated with small subsidies and permit the focus to be on the larger ones would be greatly supported. Another comment, we have documented concerns with current funding thresholds, increased time delays in finalizing projects, the additional financial burden in staff time and applicant fees, reporting requirements, and unneeded regulatory burdens of the law. Final comment, recommended changes to the state business subsidy law will enhance our ability to work with private business so that certain information is not made public as it relates to our very small community competitiveness. Personally, many of the communities I work with do not have staff time or expertise and are required to contract out for services to comply with the law. In most cases, the projects they see are generated by their own established local businesses, which further complicate the problems of confidentiality and public hearings. There are quite a few counties and communities that charge an application fee to cover administrative expenses that are incurred with various forms of assistance. This adds to the cost of the project without any guarantee of a final award. Another significant drawback is with multiple jurisdictions involved in a single project, the extension of time requirements to satisfy all public hearings can add months to the process. A report that was issued in 2003 by Good Jobs First, a civic engagement advocate agency located in Washington, D.C., highlights the benefits gained by the state of Minnesota with the enactment of the business subsidy law. We are in agreement with the need for stated public purpose of any public assistance, communities and agencies developing criteria for subsidies, cumulative and accurate reporting of costs versus benefits received, and the imposition of financial penalties for noncompliance. We are not asking for any changes to those legislative requirements. Equipment and technology expenditures are very expensive and require as much leverage of public and private financing as possible to reduce the individual risk. Most, if not all, the projects I have been involved with have required private equity investment, commercial banking participation, and public partnerships in order to make it work. I have yet to see a project with only public funding at risk. The analogy given by the city of Windham was that you can't even buy a car for $25,000, let alone a piece of manufacturing equipment. Thank you.
Questions? I guess for me. Representative Clark, I thought you might have some questions on this, since this probably might be your original language, but I'm not sure.
Right. It is, Mr. Chairman. I just had a couple, I guess I should ask a couple questions. Even no deals have fallen through because of this requirement.
Those were comments in the resolutions and the letters of support to the business subsidy change. Mm-hmm. And I didn't delineate who made those comments, but I can provide those. Mm-hmm.
But that's reassuring, Mr. Chairman. I mean, part of what the reason we passed this legislation years ago, and I was the author of it, is because we had so many questions that were raised about, you know, why does one business get a subsidy and not others, and what is the public benefit? So this is a pretty simple process of people, first of all, grant is having some criteria in place, and then you have a public hearing and the public gets to weigh in on it, and those businesses get to compete for who's actually offering the best jobs and the best economic development to a community, and it's not done behind closed doors, it's done out in the public, and so there's a lot more disclosure. I don't know if there really is a, you know, a magic number. You want to raise it from 25,000 way up to 200,000. I don't know how you came to the 200,000. One comment that I thought was kind of interesting, I was listening very carefully to what you said, and I think there's some individual or business that said, well, there's no benefit to this law. I just remind you that this was a bipartisan law. I think it was Representative Krinke, and I can't remember who else at the time helped offer the legislation with me, and it really had to do with making sure that there was accountability for corporate subsidy or corporate welfare. It was one way we talked about it. We both, you know, he used those words. So that if we're giving subsidies to businesses, we should at least have the same kind of some of the same kind of accountability that individuals have when they're receiving public assistance. So one of the things here that it says, you know, the following forms of financial assistance are not a business subsidy. So if you can get up to $200, $200,000, and it's not a business subsidy, what would you call it?
Representative Dill, do you want to act tackle that one?
Well, I think for Mr. Chairman and Representative Clark, for the purposes of this discussion, it's all about triggering the public hearing. And I want to go back to something you said a few moments ago. I'm the city administrator and had actually working with Ms. Christensen, we did quite a few deals in my community, and we had the public hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And no one comes. I can't remember in all the deals I ever did that anyone ever showed up at the public hearing except the city council. And as you raise at $25,000, because if you go down to Wally's Auto in town, you can't buy a new Dodge minivan for $25,000. So people just look at it and go, well, so it's $25,000. But as you raise the threshold to some higher number, I think you begin to get people's attention. I don't think that the idea is that this isn't a public subsidy, regardless whether it's $25, $35, $50, $100, or $200. It's a matter of where do you begin to capture the imagination of the people that they're interested in coming to the hearings in the first place. Now, I can't talk about other cities or other parts of the state, but at this low level, it just doesn't draw the attention of the community in the real scheme of things to warrant having hearings that people don't attend. And so the idea is to raise the threshold up, make it more streamlined for a business who might be willing to locate in a community where there might be a public subsidy, a business subsidy. And then if the threshold is high enough, people will read in the public notice that you put down at the post office or in on the internet or wherever the three minimum places that you post a notice are, that, oh, we better go up there and find out what's going on. They're giving away quite a bit of our money. And so actually you encourage people to come by having a higher amount. I've always found out at the city council, when you're talking nickels and dimes, nobody pays any attention. But when you're talking real money, they pay attention. So that's kind of my take on it as a city administrator.
Chairman?
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you for explaining your thoughts about that. Of course, the $25,000 for car is not public, it's subsidized. You know, it is real money to some jurisdictions, but again, I don't know if that's the magic number. Maybe it could be changed somewhat. It just seems like a pretty big leap. But I got to tell you, some of the people who most supported having this kind of discussion were the city council members, because they themselves were not aware of some of the details that were going on in their own economic development, business, their own economic development agency. So they got to weigh in on it. So I don't think it's a failure if city council members are the main ones who are there hearing about what is being proposed for taxpayer subsidy to a particular business. So it is great when you have more public involvement, but there's nothing wrong with at least having those city council members hear about it and actually be accountable for making the decision. And one of the things they told us they liked, and again, we went all around the state trying to figure out what was the right kind of thing to put in this. So one of the things they liked is it did bring out into the open the competition between, for example, something like a fairly a larger business like a Walmart or somebody who was trying to get a break or get a subsidy versus some of a mom and pop store on Main Street. It was no longer behind closed doors. It was something happening out in front of the public. So, I mean, I just wanted to review with you some of the reasoning that went into that in terms of the public. And again, I don't know if it's a magic number. It seems kind of big. I guess what you're also saying is the criteria for awarding the business subsidy, that would also jump up or not? I'm trying to understand. It looks like on page 3 that the criteria still, is that continues at $25,000? Business loan or guarantee that continues at $75,000? Is that right? And it's just is it only the public hearing that you're changing here? You still have the other requirements that there be information on the job wages, job created wages, and so on. Is that right?
That's correct. Ms. Chair, we're changing the triggering mechanism for the public hearing. And Ms. Hani is here. Maybe she'd like to add something to that.
Ms. Hani, members, by the way, I have two of my high school classmates who were both much younger than me, I might add, at the table out there. Welcome. See, we're running the world. You people just don't realize it. Welcome.
You know, for $25,000 or less.
Why do you think we're going to 200,000?
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Kathy Hani. I'm a lawyer at JJ Benson and represent the Economic Development Association of Minnesota. And I think you were younger than, are younger than I am. So.
Well, I don't look it.
Representative Clark, what we are doing is raising the threshold for purposes of the public hearing and some of the reporting requirements. However, we are not raising the threshold for purposes of the wage requirements and the job criteria requirements. What we wanted to make sure that we do is keep those lower $25,000, $75,000 thresholds on the loans and grants for when the entity that is giving the business subsidies, so that they still have to, you know, because they set their wage goals and their job goals, and so we want those important pieces of this process to apply to the lower levels. And just one comment on what happens in the context of the public hearing as well. Business that applies their financial statements and financial information, sort of their business plans, becomes public information once something is approved, and that also sort of causes a business to pause at a $25,000, $50,000, $75,000, you know, at those lower levels of dollar amounts. And again, we don't mean to dismiss the value of $100,000 because it means a lot to everybody, but it is a challenge for some of the businesses to put themselves through this public process where so much of their information becomes public when they, you know, could go to a bank or figure out some other way. So often that then doesn't bring them into the system and into a relationship with the local economic development agencies, which is what we want to work on building, that relationship, that respect for each other in order to continue to work together through the years.
Mr. Chairman, does this also mean that they don't have to report? It's a one-page form. I know that usually the report. Does this mean they also don't have to report the number of jobs that they created and the wages? Is that also wiped out by up to $200,000?
Chairman Rosavina, the intent is not to circumvent any of the public policy or reporting. It's just that, I'm going back to my small communities that I work with, they don't have the staff. They don't have the expertise. They have to hire out. So it's adding additional administrative burden for a very small loan. I know just with San Luis County, I charge $3,000 application fees. They don't get that back. There's no guarantee of an award. So it's adding additional expenses to the project. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, we have the staff time, but I'm thinking Buell has an administrative clerk, and it's difficult for him.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I suppose with Steve DeVere, $3,000 to get a $100,000 subsidy might be a pretty good deal for a lot of small businesses. I don't know. I'm trying, and it's certainly valuable for $200,000. Am I misunderstanding something you just said?
Chairman.
Go ahead.
The fee is flat irrespective of the dollar amount of proposed award. It could be a $3,000. It'll cost them $3,000
to apply. Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think a business is going to apply for a subsidy like that. Let's be realistic here. What people are talking about is taxpayers' money, and what we're talking about is accountability. And I just, in a good business sense, no one's going to apply for something that's totally not. I don't think you really meant that, right? Okay. I'm not saying that 25 is absolutely the way it should be, but it seems like a pretty big jump, and I'm trying to understand if this. I still don't understand the answer to my question about whether or not then they still need to report anything. If they get a $75,000 loan.
Ms. Hines, can you answer that question for us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, they would be exempted from the reporting requirements under the new language. We hold our feet to the fire on the wage and the job requirements, but on that, you know, it would raise the reporting thresholds to the $200,000 level.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what the reporting is the reporting of the wages and the jobs created and the wages. That's what you're reporting. So how do you know what, the, you know, if you say, we're going to hold your feet to the fire, but you never have to report and tell us if you really did it until you get the $200,000, why would that be a good idea?
Chairman, you know, every business subsidy will require a business subsidy agreement. All of the communities that enter into business subsidies have to have established policy and criteria. That is where we have allowed them to set what is appropriate for my community. What levels will I participate in economic development? with those business subsidy agreements, that does hold the seat for the fire. Whether you're saying it's not formally reported to the state, they still have their due diligence, they still have their compliance requirements, and those city councils are very much involved with the activities in their community.
Mr. Mr. Last comment, I guess.
I'm sorry.
One of the things that happened after this bill passed, there was a lot of resistance out there. It wasn't an easy bill to pass, but people were used to getting subsidies without ever having to have criteria to report or anything, and we said, no, we're going to start requiring some criteria in public. You know, interest needs to be stated, and they can compete with each, business can compete with each other, and so on. And we had people not reporting for several years. They didn't just automatically start obeying the law. So I don't know what the compliance is right now. Maybe someone could tell us from the department. Are we getting good compliance? I can say even my own city had a problem. We had to push them. You know, and there were some issues with people wanting to comply with, you know. That's the law said. So I'm just wondering if we could give a little information on that.
Is there anybody from DEED that can answer the question on the compliance? No, you don't have it off the top of your head. Okay. Well, welcome to the committee.
My name is Lynn Bassley, and I'm with DEED, and I'm sorry I don't have that information with me, but I can get it for you tomorrow.
Representative Clark and members, and Representative Eastland has a question too, but you bring up some legitimate concerns, and I think, you know, Ms. Christensen is saying, and Representative Dill, he does have a legitimate point. Nobody's coming to these meetings, and they're just there for, you know, the sake of having a meeting. That's one thing. I don't think the intent with the language on page 2 was to undo what your main reason for having this. If I recall, I sat on many of your corporate welfare meetings, and you know, main concern of yours was openness and people making a decent wage off of those subsidies. And so the decent wage is still in here. If we need reporting requirements to give you some comfort level, I'm sure Representative Dill could work with you. I have to send this because of our process back up to finance, but I think because that's where it came from. So finance probably just sent it right to the floor, but in the meantime, you know, if you let it out as it is this evening, you could work on that and probably put back in then where it was deleted, and I don't see where the deletion was, the reporting requirement. That would be okay with you, Representative Clark, and Representative Dill could work with you on that. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dill, I want to go to the kind of the public hearing component here. So what this bill does is it eliminates a number of public hearings for smaller grants. Is that basically in a nutshell what it does?
And more. Representative Dill.
It eliminates a public hearing. When a business subsidy is given, there's a requirement to have a public hearing.
Right, but I mean, there could be many of those. So it eliminates a public hearing in each grant situation when those amounts are smaller. And I guess the language here, I'm looking at on page 3, line 22, it says the grantor must provide a public notice and a hearing on the subsidy. And I know the public notice is referring to basically when the hearing is going to be. But I guess the question I have is there a way that a public notice about the subsidy, even when it's smaller, is it included in the minutes of a unit of government or something? So when these subsidies are given in smaller amounts, so that there at least is a public record that people could go to find where these subsidies are? I think that's kind of the question I have. I mean, this public money, even though it's small amounts, there should be some place where it's recorded that the public could know about it if they want to know.
Representative Dill, you're in trouble now. You got Eastman and Clark on the same side. So go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastman, it actually is. If you have an EDA, for example, EDA is an extension of city government or county government or the local unit of government, responsible governmental unit, and they, of course, are bound to keep records, accurate records of their proceedings, which are public. As well, a city council or a county, anytime that there is a granting of a public subsidy, obviously there has to be, just as there is here, a record of the proceedings. And those minutes are kept in the fashion in which the local unit of, a responsible unit of government keeps them. In my little town of 261 people, we've given out a pile of public subsidies to try and do economic development, and our little community prints our at a great expense, prints all of our minutes in the local newspaper, because we know that people don't come to the hearings because they're busy, but they need to know that. Now, there are different ways that different communities handle that or counties handle that, but the answer to your question is yes. There is a formal record of a proceeding when, whether there's a public hearing held or if it's under the threshold and there's a, just a local unit of government or the EDA gives a grant, let's say a small grant or a really small loan, a micro loan, let's say. There's a record of that.
Representative, and I guess just from a, the standpoint of kind of getting past this issue, I mean, it's not in here, but could it be in here that, that a local community is required to publish grants, you know, at that are given, public grants that are given? And that has to be that's all you have to do. I mean, you don't have to go into a lot of detail, but at least make a note. So if somebody does want to go and dig up the information, they can go to the EDA or they can go wherever they have to go and dig it out and find out what it is. I just think that's kind of a transparency piece that would give everybody more comfort here.
Chairman,
yeah.
Well, if it's comfort language that Representative Clark and Representative Eastland are interested in, we. I mean, we're into comfort around here, you know that. And but in practicality, as I said earlier, every time that there's a public subsidy given, whether there's a hearing or not, whether it's a microloan of $100 to someone to start a home business or $200 or $1,000, that when the city council gives it, it's public money, or if a county gives it or an EDA gives it, there has to be a record of it, and those records are public and it is recorded. So if it's comfort we are after, we'll comfort we'll get. But in practicality, it's recorded and it is public.
Representative, and you can work with Representative Dillon at comfort level in New York. Representative Haas.
Thank you. I think it's published in a couple of spots. Certainly it's published in the minutes, which is required by law. And at the end of the year, all the bills that are taken by the city and the county is published in both the record, newspaper of record, and one other newspaper.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, Representative Detmer renews his motion that House File 3602 be recommended to pass and referred to his finance committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Congratulations, Representative Dill. I think we will take out of order Representative Eastland's Bill 3628 because I see there's a number of interest in the audience. Representative Eastland moves that House File 3628 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Retired Safety and Workforce Development Bill. Representative Eastland. Representative
Dill. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I guess, first of all, I'd like to say that this is an issue that I've learned this. Got a lot of interest by a lot of different parties, and so I hope we can have a good discussion. My concern with this issue started when I began to think of the MISCU system that we have in our state as being a seamless system. I have a technical college in my district, or close to my district, that I call my own, and I have a branch of a community college in my district, and a few years ago, before I was on this, I think probably, I don't know who on this committee was on there, when the systems were put together, I think the goal was to make our college system seamless so that students would have the best chance of being able to start and finish and not have to waste a lot of time. What I found anecdotally from a number of people, from one technical college president, from one community college president, from a number of students, is that oftentimes students who start in our college system and are have an undeclared major particularly and who begin to take some general education classes start in their college career, they take the advice of counselors and they take general education credits, and by the time they get done with their first year and they begin to look at declaring a major, when they look at transferring those credits into the major that they want in a different school, oftentimes there's credits, even though that they transfer, they will not transfer to fulfill requirements that are necessary. So what students end up having to do is actually take more credits to get their final degree. And I think what we should be about here is creating a system where students are free to be able to get through their college four-year degree as quickly and efficiently as possible. And so if there's things that we can do in our system that can make it more seamless, if there's things that we can do in our system to identify courses that we know are going to be able to transfer across school lines so that they will qualify for credits for certain requirements, certain basic requirements in different majors, we should do our best to identify those. And so that's what I've done here, is try to offer a bill that would move us in the direction of a common course numbering system that would more clearly identify for students what the courses are that they need to take in their general education area so that they will cross major lines and degree lines and be able to be used to fulfill the requirements. So first of all, I think I have an amendment. Is there an amendment in the packet? And I guess, first of all, what I'd like to do is just offer the amendment. That is a language clarification that was recommended that would bring more clarity to this issue. And I'd like to move that amendment at this point.
Representative Easton moves the DE1.
It's the only one, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I don't know. I'm probably on the wrong bill. No, this is it. So go ahead. Do you want to explain the amendment?
The amendment just clarifies the language so that I think it has clarifies the core curriculum issue and tries to get at the issue of what a common course numbering system would accomplish. But
Representative Easton moves to delete all amendments to DE1. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails.
And rather than me explain more about something that I don't know very much about, I would defer to Scott Fomo, here with us from the Student Association, to maybe explain how this issue affects students and how we could make some improvements to it.
Mr. Fomo, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Rukavina, and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to address you here today regarding the two-year student perspective on Representative Eastland's bill relating to the Common Core System within the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. For the record, my name is Scott Palmer. I'm president of the Minnesota State College Student Association, and I believe everybody's been passed a memo with a written copy of my testimony also. At a recent board meeting, our students held a discussion regarding the Common Course Numbering proposal. We put forward the original bill to our students for discussion, as well as some ideas for changes that might make the bill more effective in dealing with some specific transfer issues within the system. After some discussion, students gave the unanimous support for the concept of a common course system that would allow for a simplified transfer structure within MinSCU. While we recognize the complexity of the transfer issues across the system, we believe this may be a step in the right direction towards solving some long-term transfer issues that should have been resolved by now with the maturation of the Minnesota transfer curriculum and the Minnesota course applicability system. The intricacies of transfer issues have cultivated lengthy discussions that yielded little agreement on a process that allows students to transfer credits without being forced to retake courses that meet the core general education requirements of the chosen degree or getting lost in a wilderness of bureaucracy. We recognize the efforts made by the Office of the Chancellor at MinSCU to address some of the concerns that students have had regarding transfer issues. Over the past 2 years, MinSCU has created many tools that attempt to assist students with the complexity of the transfer process, including the Degree Audit Reporting System, referred to as DARS, MinCAS, or the Minnesota Course Applicability System, the Minnesota Transfer Curriculum, and the presence of transfer specialists on each campus to work directly with students on the issues of transferability. We appreciate the efforts made by MinSCU in these areas, but feel that there is still much work that needs to be done in the area of determining true equivalency of courses within the system. With me today is Amy Bolton, who is a graduate of Rochester Community and Technical College, and a current student at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. Amy served 2 terms as treasurer of MSDSA and is very knowledgeable of MinSCU and issues affecting students. And she'll explain the personal challenges she faced in attempting to transfer credits from RCTC to a number of four-year institutions within the state. At this point, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn over the floor to Ms. Bolton so she can share her testimony with the committee.
Scott, are you done with your testimony then?
I have just a couple of...
Why don't you finish up and then we'll go to Ms.
Okay. Students face a variety of challenges when it comes to transfer issues because of many different individual circumstances. The situation Amy Amy is going to testify to the TSA. It's a demonstrative of a single piece of the issues raised by this legislation before the committee today. In an attempt to deal with some of the remaining concerns for students like Amy, the Delete All Amendment would narrow the focus of the Common Core system while streamlining the transfer process for the Minnesota Transfer Curriculum Requirements and emphasis areas for the Associate in Arts degree. Representative Eastland's bill would benefit students in their attempts to transfer credits and would also guarantee credit applicability to their transfer program of choice and allow for greater access opportunities through concurrent enrollment sites without increasing costs to the institution. Perhaps more importantly, this proposal could assist students in attaining their educational goals in a timely manner, putting them into the workforce sooner. In no way do we intend to impede on the faculty control of the course curriculum, as this legislation will continue to allow faculty to develop their curriculum to meet course learning outcomes that they deem necessary. Along with the positive impact this bill would have on students and the state, the timing cannot be better for this measure to be implemented. With the program review anticipated in the implementation of the new 5120 credit cap legislation and proposed waiver procedure, the evaluation over the next few years creates a great opportunity for the concurrent development of a common course system. After serving on the credit cap task force, I'm confident the Office of the Chancellor can create a process to implement a system that will work to benefit all parties involved. We do, however, recognize the financial and time implications this legislation may have on the system in order to bring faculty members from across the state together to reach an agreement on what constitutes common learning outcomes that would be needed in order to bring this legislation in life, but in the end, we believe that it would be a benefit to the students of Minnesota State College and University. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to testify on behalf of the bill.
Questions of the witness? Did you have a question? Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, and to the testifier, I guess I'm surprised that we don't have conformity already within the system of Memsky. What efforts have been applied to try to get uniformity and being that it brought you here to the legislature to try to have this happen? So what steps have been taken to maybe within the system to do it on your own?
Mr. Formo, do you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, I believe that it would be a fair statement to say that over the past few years, the Minnesota transfer curriculum has evolved to be somewhat of a curriculum or a course that is going along these lines. And I think that has evolved quite a bit over the past few years to be more representative of addressing the issue. They have developed some of the other tools that will actually help students to transfer issues, but I believe, as you might understand a little bit better, there's still some areas of what we refer to as a seamless pipeline that are still leaking in that pipeline. And I think some of the areas that Ms. Bolton will testify to might help to clarify that a little bit more as far as some of the other issues that still need to be addressed that this legislation could help to address.
Ms. Bolton, welcome to the committee.
Chair Ruzumina, committee members, thank you for your time today and for considering this important legislation. Faith in the public education system is an important aspect of being a student in Minnesota. And when I began taking classes at Rochester Community and Technical College, I intended to complete my 2-year degree and transfer to a 4-year institution to obtain my degree in education. I depended on academic advisors to guide me in my educational plan. I met with academic counselors each time before I registered for classes, charting a course for transfer that would lead to successful degree completion. In 2004, I graduated from RCTC with an Associate of Arts degree, having taken all the necessary courses to transfer to a 4-year institution. When I began looking for programs available to me, I found some unexpected roadblocks. My first encounter was when I began looking into the program at Minnesota State Mankato, 2+2 with Normandale. I quickly learned that there were too many courses that would only be accepted if I took them at Normandale for transfer. This would have added an additional year to my education, which would have cost nearly $2,900 in tuition and $290 in fees. As it was clear that this was not a viable choice for me, I began looking into other programs. I settled on the Delight program delivered by Bemidji State University. Much to my surprise, similar glitches in the transfer process were revealed at orientation. Courses that I was advised to take in order to meet the requirements of an education degree would not transfer to Bemidji. This meant another costly delay in time and expense to my degree completion. During orientation at Bemidji, we were told that certain courses would need to be retaken. We were given information on the appeals process, but it was abundantly clear that this would be an exercise in futility. The dean of the education program let us know that if the course was not taken at Bemidji or at an institution with whom there was an articulation agreement, it would not be accepted. Therefore, the courses that I took at Rochester that were part of the Rochester Winona 2+2 program were useless. Here again, students are bearing the brunt of the bureaucratic process, costing them time and money. I began to feel as though the concept of a seamless education is just rhetoric. It's seamless only to those institutions that have a previous agreement, which incidentally, students are not made aware of ahead of time. In cases such as these, it appears that institutions are functioning as individual entities and not as a system that makes education accessible and affordable. After attending Bemidji State University for 1 year, I transferred to Augsburg College. From the outset, I could see that my experience there was going to be much different. The friendly student environment was one where all my coursework would transfer, and I would not be required to retake courses for which I had already paid. During this process, I found that there are no difficult forms or grueling red tape to wade through. I simply take my syllabus and perhaps my book to the dean's office. We meet, look over the goals and objectives, and she decides whether it meets the requirements or not. While I understand that my situation may seem to be somewhat unrelated to what Representative Eastland is trying to accomplish with this legislation, it really isn't. While the Minnesota Transfer Curriculum portion of the Associate of Arts degree has become more transferable in the past couple of years, the courses required for specific areas of emphasis are subject to articulation agreements between two or more colleges or universities. According to the MinSpU website, students pursue the Associate of Arts degree with an emphasis in a variety of areas including education, art, history, biology, engineering, social work, and pre-professional programs such as dentistry, law, medicine, and veterinary science. Many times, these focused courses serve as the prerequisites to the upper division courses for a baccalaureate program. In time, this legislation could potentially eliminate the need for individual articulation agreements within the MinSpU system and allow for more universal transfer degree options for students. I'm seriously at a loss for why the public system cannot have such ease of transfer. The system loses students to private and proprietary institutions every year, losing both valuable funds and non-tangibles as well. In my case, for example, I've gone on to be a leader at Augsburg. I've worked to help develop the Weekend College Student Government Association, and I'm currently serving as the first student body president of Weekend College while continuing to pursue my degree. Imagine what students would bring to the public education system if transfer was fair and equitable, and it was a system that was easily navigated.
Thank you, Ms. Boston. Questions? Representative Devon.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I guess I can relate to what you were saying there. My wife and I had a daughter that just graduated from Bethel, and she took a year of college in Germany, and all of her credits transferred from Germany to her Bethel for her degree. And I guess I'm surprised that we don't have that same seamlessness in our MinSpU system.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I ask you first, Amy, what your major is or what you transferred as a major?
I'm sorry. I'm in special education and due to graduate in June.
And that was your major when you were at RCTC as well?
Yep.
Okay. I just have to lay this on the table. I am a transfer specialist at a community college, and I'll just tell you that I would strongly oppose this bill, so I'm going to lay that out on the table to begin with. But I guess some of my issues with this is I don't think it's the course numbering system that's at fault or at a problem. I think that, as has been mentioned, MinSpU has done a very good job, I think, of developing a transfer curriculum, the Minnesota transfer curriculum. I work with students who are transferring to private colleges, public colleges, in-state colleges, out-of-state colleges on a daily basis. When I'm at my job at Riverlawn Community College, we work with students who are trying to figure out what their major is going to be. They're working on all of that. And it sounds extremely unfortunate that you've had this situation happen to you. I would suspect, I would hope that you have got to be in the minority of the number of students who have issues with transferring course credits and being able to go from one class and one course to another course. I think that a freshman English class numbered at my college is going to be numbered differently at Bemidji State or numbered differently at Drake University in Iowa, but it's going to be something that a student's going to be able to take and say, I had a freshman English English composition class, and be able to count that. So I guess it's probably good to have the discussion with Ms. Dentivisan, but I'm still not quite. I don't know where this is leading as far as how this is going to be an answer to something that I'm thinking is in a rare situation.
Well, Representative Poppy, you know, I don't have a dog in this fight. Representative Eastland asked if I'd sign on the bill. It kind of made sense. I've heard pros and cons from it, but I don't see how anybody sitting at this table can think that in the Minscu system, Minnesota State Community Colleges, technical colleges, our four-year institutions, where you take a course in one, and somebody tells you it doesn't transfer at Normandale because you didn't take the class at Normandale in conjunction with Mankato, or you didn't take it at Bemidji in conjunction with Rainy River. That's something is fundamentally wrong if that's what's going on out there. Maybe what happened to Ms. Boston is an anomaly, but I don't know if that's the case or not. Did you in Bemidji, I guess I'd have to ask you, did you lose credits when you went to Bemidji then when you said the same thing, something similar happened?
Chair, I would have been required to retake courses that I had taken at RCTC. For instance, there's a health education course that's required. I took it at RCTC, and it would have transferred to Winona for my education prerequisite, but it would not to Bemidji. I believe the same is also true to a course, a sociology course that's required for that degree, and it wouldn't transfer. We needed to take it either at Bemidji or a school that they had an agreement with.
Representative Siebert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a little bit to that point, I have a niece who has taken the sign language down, or up at St. Cloud Technical College, came down here and received numerous courses down here, but refused to give credit for the courses up in St. Cloud. So they're, you know, it's the same deal. This is not an isolated issue. I mean, if it's happening to someone I know at random, I would tend to lean into this thing and say, you know, it's probably a little more widespread than we're really perceiving at this point. And I was just, Mr. Chair, I was just curious as to if we have, I just had a brain dump there. I'll have that question back in a minute. Thanks.
Thank you. I'll give you an iron range sign here in a little bit. Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just take a couple minutes because I think we'll hear several of these issues from some of those who might testify in opposition. But I'm very sympathetic to the issues around this bill, and I did sign on the bill. But I took my name off the bill, and I'll just give you a quick story here. My husband teaches at Minnesota State University Mankato, and I probably heard from at least half of the faculty of that university, and I mean it. Emails, phone calls, stopping in the grocery store, all I want to say is what I've come to recognize is it's a very complicated issue, and I don't think the right move is to require a Common Course catalog. I think we need to do some studying and exchange here because, first of all, the Minscu system itself, as we all know, is a work in progress. And all of these institutions have long-standing traditions that they're working from, and they vary from department to department and, you know, university to university. So I think we have to respect some of the historical context for the discussion and work from there. But I do think that faculty don't always adequately see what students go through coming from one school to another. They're looking at a whole complex of issues about, you know, trying to offer the very highest and best level of education from it within their program, and they're kind of protective of their own territory and not always willing to concede that another institution might offer something that's exactly the same. So I think there's a lot of conversation that has to occur. And I'm just saying that I really think the first step is dialogue. What's going on with the current transfer process? What's wrong with it? What could be done to fix it? Before we move to a mandate for a Common Course catalog.
Well, Representative Breinert, I think that the lead all kind of eases up a little bit on that's what it did. But, you know, I was here in 1992 when the systems merged, and that's 16 years ago, you know. So we should have had a little dialogue over the last 16 years, because if you want to open this up, let's open it up to an argument right now. Who at this table doesn't think that if you took a program at Normandale and it worked at Mankato because they're in with each other, and if you took it at Rochester and it'll transfer to Winona, or if you took it at Mesabi Community College and it transfers to Bemidji, that it shouldn't work for the same program, whether it's at Mankato, Bemidji, or Winona? Let's start with that concept. Who doesn't think that's the correct concept? Raise your hand. Representative Wealthy doesn't. Okay, that's one. Okay, Representative Moe doesn't either. That's two. Okay, let's hear your reason why.
I have a question. Thank you.
And then we have Monty up here for the full Monty.
I'm just gonna give you a little bit of perspective. When I was attending college, I did hear of a number of students that had issues with transferring credits. But I don't know necessarily if they were a part of MINSCU system when they were transferring to another MINSCU institution, if they were transferring from out of state. I mean, when students are transferring, and they're transferring from all over. But what I would say is, when we were talking about, you know, the first bill that you brought forth, the 3628, as it was originally written, that's a little bit more acceptable to me. But then I take a look at the new one, and it didn't lighten up. And I'll give you a reason. I just want the members to think about this. Go down to line 1.11 or line 1.12. It says, for all remaining programs, the institution awarding the degree must consider including core curriculum within the general education courses. Upon review and documentation, core curriculum courses that do not satisfy the standards of a program or field of study must not be required courses. At Minnesota State University in Mankato, where I went to get my education degree, they had some programs that were tailored for education, for a specific program, for instance, for myself, in secondary social studies education, that were tailored the way that they were because the person who was, my advisor also taught the social studies courses. And we had a really good program, and it's recognized throughout southern Minnesota as a top-notch social studies program. Some of the requirements that we have just to get into the College of Education are unique to Mankato. And so if we're going to be putting in language that says that you cannot have a certain program in order to, you know, satisfy the requirements of the education program at Mankato, I don't think that's why. I could see us putting into place a certain type of program for just the basic English, freshman English course, and saying that should have a common number throughout the system. But to go beyond that and say that you cannot have any type of special class or any other class outside the core curriculum for your program, I do not think that is a wise move.
Representative Welty, as you can see with this delete all, it's a work in progress. I think the students are asking for something that, for something to happen after 16 years of the merger having taken place. Representative Mo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in general, I'm with the students on a lot of things, too, and I understand that they need some accountability and value for their dollars. I think that, as you said, it's a work in progress. There's something we can do here, but I don't think we're there yet. And I'm going to echo a little bit what Representative Welty said. I was involved in the development of a curriculum at the Bemidji State University for outdoor education recreation, and we were able to use some of the core requirements in that first 2 years to apply towards a minor degree. And we were able to do that because they were specific to that minor degree. But that same course requirement at Mankato or Rochester probably wouldn't have covered that the same material. And so what this would require us to do is that minor program, or in some cases major programs, would have to either take that course from another school that doesn't have the curriculum in place that you wanted for that major or minor, or disband the minor or major, put it on hold until you get that curriculum in place. Does that make sense? So effectively, this would make it put either in a holding pattern, the minor or major that we're working on, or make us adjust that minor or major accordingly. Now those are things that could be accomplished eventually, but developing curriculum for a class or for a course of study takes quite a bit of time, and you've given us a year here, and I just don't know that could happen. I mean, and I think that ultimately the challenge would be some programs would be either put on the back burner, or, you know, there would be some significant headaches to try to get there in that short period of time. And in the end, maybe some students would lose out because that major or minor that they were involved with, they might not have that available to them. Do you follow me?
Representative Mo, I follow you, and there are certain, you know, things that I don't understand, and I don't claim to be, you know, the brightest guy at this table. In fact, I'm probably the least brightest guy. But let me tell you what I think. I think that if I went to a community college, and every semester, or then it was quarters, I went to my academic counselor, and I asked her or him, what should I take to get to the next step when I move on, whether it's to St. Cloud or UMD or Harvard, and they told me what to take, and then it didn't work out, I think I'd go to my state representative and senator and ask that counselor to pay my tuition. That's what I think. So that's just my opinion. Representative Poppy, not you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, if that ever does happen at my college, we do and reimburse that student if there's been an error in advising that student, because it is something that we pay attention to. We want them. I'm a strong student advocate. I really do want the students to get the most bang for their buck. I mean, they should be going through. They should be able to get all of the courses that they need at our college, be able to transfer. I don't think it's a flawless system. I just don't think it's as broken as is being portrayed. I do think, too, that there can be, I guess I just don't...
That's right there. Great standing state. Mr. Formal, is this an exception to the rule, what happened, Ms. Boston, or is this something you hear about as...
Mr. Chair, that's kind of a difficult question to answer. What we hear about are the problems and the issues that people face. And as part of, you know, the position I'm in is trying to look to what kinds of things that are working well, but obviously on the other end of it, what kinds of things could we be doing better at? So more so than not, the stories that we hear are similar to Ms. Bolton's, and that there are more issues that we hear about. That doesn't mean that is the majority of the issues. That those are just the ones that we tend to hear about more frequently.
Representative Popkin, I'm sorry.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. The other piece of this is the common course numbering part doesn't necessarily equate to common course content. And I think that's maybe something, at least in my mind, I'm thinking the Minnesota Transfer Curriculum does allow for a student, as I mentioned, to take freshman English, or if I take an intro to sociology class, or something that's generally considered a general education freshman or sophomore level class,
that could be common. So if you take it at Riverland Community College, it should be the same as Rochester Community and Technical College, same as Bemidji State. So you should, yes, absolutely, those, there should be no denying that those are the courses that you take and that you have, that you have those. So, so a little bit of this is the common, the common numbering system, I think, is a little misleading as being the thing to fix it. I think that Representative Moe talked about some specialty kinds of courses that maybe a college is going to offer and develop. I would agree that if we have students who are facing this on a fairly regular basis, by golly, we should be fixing that, because that's an issue. And again, I really want to work with students to make sure that they're getting through the system and making the best choices, the best decisions when they're at my institution, to be able to then go on to another university to be able to take the courses and not have to repeat courses. So I work with the transfer specialist for the, you know, for the four-year colleges, but I'm just, again, not convinced that a common course numbering system is the place to go to solve what the problems are that apparently, you know, a number of students perhaps have faced. I just, again, think that you're hopefully not hearing from the hundreds or thousands of students who are successfully transferring.
Representative Poppe, thank you. We'll hear from the opposition to this bill shortly. Representative Stevenson, Mahoney, Bly, Detmer, on this sticker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question needs to come to the forefront is, who is the customer here? Because the one that's paying the tuition, the one that's working 20 hours a week to pay that tuition, is finding out after they've gone through a couple of semesters that some of those courses aren't transferring. And they've put with good faith and effort into this process. If we've had this process in works for 16 years, how much longer is it going to take to make it happen? And I think, you know, in this provision where we basically write a timeline and say, you got a year to square this away. And because we've left a line of individuals in the past. I mean, I can attest to at least a couple who have done that. So they've been working for, you know, hundreds of hours to subsidize this, their education, and then find out that those don't transfer. I think this is a very reasonable approach. We need to define who is the customer. Obviously, you know, these are some professors in the university system, and they're taking it from their perspective. And I remember what my question was to Representative Reiner. Her question was, who's in opposition to this? Well, we're seeing it. It's the Minsky system themselves, because they have...
Representative Peterson, we also have, I think, the four-year student association, if I'm not mistaken, against it too, but...
I mean, they're all over, there's Mr. Yolke. So they're all over the board here. But, you know, it's a great discussion, because like the discussion we had last week on the 60 and 120 credits, it's a pertinent discussion for this committee that's both a policy and a finance committee, and we got to do our work here, and we're hearing complaints, and we should look at them. And maybe I'm totally off base, and maybe, you know, Representative Easton, well, he's been off base quite a bit. But anyway, you know, I mean, we're going to hear both sides, and we've got a few weeks to mull this over, and we'll think maybe we won't do anything. Maybe we'll just let it languish like it has.
And, Mr. Chair, just kind of a follow-on, I think, you know, some of the issues that we're talking about, you have institutions that you have incorporated into Minsky. On a private university, they each have their own identity. St. Cloud State University used to be the Teachers College, and now it's kind of morphed into this whole Minsky system. So what we're doing is we're saying there's this big group of schools, and they're all interconnected, but if you go from this one to this one, it doesn't necessarily work. They have their own identity. They've developed their own expertise, but we're telling them to meld into something that I don't think we're telling the students that necessarily carries through with.
Well, we'll hear all the cases there. Sure. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, you're not alone in supporting this and finding it just frustrating. And I'll just share with the committee that I have a someone in my district whose child is looking to transfer from one to the other. And to save that family approximately $500 a month and take advantage of a scholarship. Problem came in that student would have to lose approximately half a year. And that wasn't the biggest part of the problem, but because the classes in their four-year plan were only offered at a certain time, This person went from graduating in 4 years to probably having to go 5.5. So, I don't know what's broken, but if we're giving Minsky $70 or $80 million for their central office, they ought to have some pretty goddamn smart people there that can figure out how to fix this.
We gave them 62.5 last year, so I think they've gotten a little more than that. But anyway, Representative Klein.
I'm sensing this is a more complex issue than than it might first appear. I as an educator, I certainly respect individual faculty members and departments to design programs the way that they see fits the resources that they have and the people that they have in their department. But I think ultimately, I feel very strongly the student should not be harmed by the system that we have in place. Reminds me a little bit of my experience as an alternative educator when we would have students who would be up for a diploma and they would transfer from our program to another school. Oftentimes these were traditional schools. They didn't want to accept the alternative education classes they'd taken, thinking that they were lesser courses in somehow. And we fought this very hard. I think that there should be room in any discussion looking at the transfer of credits that institutions should respect the credibility of other institutions and that you ought to be able to say these transfer in. But ultimately the bottom line should be, let's not harm the student.
I think we all agree with you on that. Thank you, Representative Blank. Representative Detmer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I guess if you get a degree at DeMichi State University, you say in education, you should be able to get the same degree in education at Mankato or St. Cloud or whatever, and those courses should be able to transfer from course to from college to college or university to university. So I just I spent my whole undergraduate degree at DeMichi, and I didn't know we were having this problem. So I hope that we can fix it.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've struggled with this and, too, have received lots of emails and contacts in the last week or two. And transferring credits has always been an issue, whether from college to college, across state lines. I mean, it's not a new issue. I think maybe what's newer here is that we have a system, and within the system of Minsky is where the frustration is. I can tell you down in Rochester, U of M, WSU, and RCTC have had a shared campus experience, and they have spent many years now working on that common curriculum so that if a student starts out at Rochester Community and Technical College and they transfer to the University of Minnesota, all the credits transfer. If they instead decide to go to WSU and on a state university, all their credits transfer. It's taken a long time, and I think it's actually been quite successful, and that's within and without of the system. And I'm not certain the issue is numbering. I guess I would question, and I'm not wanting to pick on a particular university, but the example that was given was Bemidji. Perhaps someone should question whether the school that you went to that said, sorry, but my sociology class is better than the one that you had. That really, to me, is the issue, that maybe that's an issue that needed to be handled at one college as opposed to, you know, an issue throughout the entire system.
Representative Norton, I think the question is not between Winona and Rochester Community and Technical College and the University of Minnesota Rochester. I think, as you saw, those credits from Rochester didn't transfer up to Normandale because Normandale, where I believe you wanted to go a 2+2 program, so take your other 2 years because she didn't go to Normandale, they didn't work at Mankato. So it's not just a Bemidji thing, it was a Mankato thing in that particular instance. And who knows if there's a Metro State, we'll hear from Mr. Butte here soon. But it's just a very good conversation. So why don't we just move on to the opposition.
Well, I will, Mr. Chair, but I
don't think it's a Bemidji thing.
No, and I'll pick on that because she mentioned the sociology, I think, as an example of it. My sociology class, I'm not going to accept one from another school, and I think that's a legitimate issue, but I was saying maybe it's an issue for that particular school being stubborn about their class being better than another institution's
I can
class.
Tell you, I see the president or the provost or chancellor, whatever they're called up in Bemidji, up in the audience, and he is...
He's pacing around, I'm quite
He
certain.
Is just a wonderful cooperative gentleman. I'm sure that it's not his fault at all.
He's
going to
regret going up in the
rebel,
I think.
Mr. Yopi and Butte, would you come up and tell us your point of view? Welcome to the committee. Would you just identify yourselves for the tape and make your presentation? Welcome to the committee. Mr. Lopez, you want to start this, or who?
Oh, you want me to start it?
I don't care who starts it.
Somebody on the left.
How about the guy in the middle?
Yeah. Thank you, Chairman Rukavina, members of the committee, for the opportunity to address this issue. My name, for the record, is Manuel Lopez. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Continuous Improvement in the Office of the Chancellor of Minnesota State College of the University. I'm going to do, I'm going to try to keep this short and just do a couple of stage-setting pieces.
If we can keep all the testimonies short.
Okay.
I think we've got a lot of, we have a number of bills we have.
In 2005, the latest year for which we have complete records, roughly 35,000 records were evaluated by our system institution from other institutions, both inside the system and outside our system. In addition, another 22,000 records were sent to institutions totally outside the system. For transfers within the system and to and from the University of Minnesota, we have existing tools, namely the Minnesota Transfer Curriculum. In addition, if some of you might recall, in the 2001 omnibus bill, there were restrictions placed or conditions placed on mandating the transfer of courses from the Minnesota Transfer Curriculum as awarded by any one of the Minnesota institutions when they transfer to any other of the Minnesota institutions. Just want to remind you that that is in place, and we have adopted it, put it in policy, and it is in procedure, and it is being used. For transfers into the system from outside, we have a national system, which was referred to earlier, called the Course Applicability System, CAS for short. That helps with crosswalks. The CAS system includes 198 institutions and over 2 million students nationally. The CAS system is also useful internally, as it allows students to explore options before taking courses or assess what they have taken already against offerings at other institutions, both within the system and outside, the 198 institutions, in other words, that are in the system. The proposed legislative initiative, the Common Core Numbering, does not include the University of Minnesota, the private colleges of Minnesota, colleges and universities in other states. Roughly 22,000 of the 56,000 transfers that occurred in 2005, that's 39%, are excluded from the process. The CAS system does include means of addressing transfers to all or near almost all of these: University of Minnesota, privates in the state, other Minsky institutions, publics and privates outside the state. The Minnesota Transfer Curriculum includes the Minsky institutions and the University of Minnesota. We have a joint agreement dating back to 1994. As a result, we feel that the Common Core Numbering Initiative could represent a step backwards in terms of the comprehensiveness of coverage we already have. We have a unique system, one that includes technical colleges with very distinct missions and with open enrollments to more comprehensive state universities with more structured entrance requirements. We think we have a system that functions well for the vast majority of students in our complex system. In a system as complex as ours, we are unlikely to reach perfection, but we strive for it. And in a number of notes I took with regard to some of the testimony earlier, I just want to make a comment that the core is one issue, the major is another. The core, as defined, let's say, as the Minnesota Transfer Curriculum, has been covered in statute, has been covered in policy, has been covered in procedure, and appears to work for in excess of 95% of the cases that we've dealt with. The issue of the major is totally different. You start getting into accreditation issues, you start getting into licensure issues, you talk about teacher ed. Those of you who are in education know that the Board of Teaching has as much control of that or more than we do. There are licensure issues, and a lot depends on meeting the requirements of a specific sub-major, licensure category, etc. You would not expect me, I had an undergraduate degree in Latin American area studies, to be able to move from that, let's say, after 2 years, into an engineering degree without some impact. You have to be careful where the paths are, from what type of degree to what type of degree. It is complex, it isn't seamless, but it does work for the vast majority of the students in our system. Thank you very much.
Let's hold questions until we're done. Mr. Yolfi, do you want to just hit the highlights I see on the back of your testimony on what your suggestions might be to help us out here?
Yeah,
welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is J.J. Jolfi, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State University Student Association. And before I begin, I just want to say that I'm not the expert in our office on this. Graham Allen, our government relations director, sits on the Transfer Oversight Committee, but I wasn't able to make it tonight because he's ill. And just in the interest of time, I won't go through all of the testimony. I think you all have it in the suggestions. Obviously, with Amy's testimony and some of the other comments around here, there's obviously a problem with the transferability within our institutions, and we want to do whatever we can to make that better. But I think from the students that I talked to on our board and our officers, that they didn't feel like this particular common course numbering was the way to go with it. I think Representative Poppy and others made some comments that I would echo also that make it a little very difficult for us to be able to support it at this time, but very willing to work with all of you on this, because I think, Mr. Chairman, you brought up some concerns that I have too about being able to transfer to all different institutions, and so I would be willing to continue to work on it, but this particular bill, we can't support at this time.
Thank you. Professor.
Well, good evening. It's good to be back with you again.
Your name is
Monty Butte, for the record. I teach at Metropolitan State University, and I'm speaking on behalf of the interfaculty organization. I would just like to preface my remarks, as this committee certainly knows, there's probably been no stronger advocate of students among the state university faculty in the past year. And as some of you know quite well, there's probably been no harsher critic of the Minskew Central Office than me among the faculty in this state. That said, I think the students are seriously misguided, the two-year students on this, and I think that we really need to listen to Minskew. Let me make the central point on this. We are talking apples and oranges here, and we have got to get clear this distinction. If this were 1992, this bill would be a godsend. We had chaos, we had anarchy, we had a total mess. But what has come together in 1994 with the Minnesota Transfer Agreement that has managed to pull the university in, and the Pinkel Amendment, which actually has turned out to be a wonderful thing in 2001, we have, if you were to describe this system of transfer, I would sort of put it in the terms that Winston Churchill once put about democracy. This is the worst possible transfer system, except for all other forms that have been tried from time to time. Let me make the point very clear. We have a form of federalism that is quite unique here. It is like a federalist system. It assures the autonomy of 33 campuses to make wise choices about general education, but it also manages to hold harmless every single student at those institutions. I happen to be from the Uber institution of transfer. Metro State, 95% of our students are transfer students. I have been the chair of the General Education Committee for many years. I sit on the statewide transfer oversight committee. Not one student dare be denied at another institution a course that was accepted at their sending institution. There is no way any course can be denied, and there is an appeal process. Now, that's the component of 40 credits for general education. What that does is it allows us to have a unique system where literally there are maybe 10,000 courses that you can pick and choose among and choose at your institution and absolutely be assured that when you get to another institution, it'll fit in those 40 credits. If this were to be enacted, that 10,000 courses would shrink very quickly to about 500. To get agreement within the entire system about exactly what course content is involved, what course number, would create the most minuscule system. Now market forces dictate a wide range of opportunity and options students have. But at the same time, it guarantees them, if I took Sociology 101 at Rainy River, Metro State ain't got no choice about it. It counts in Goal 5, or it counts in Goal 7. They must transfer. Now, I want you to just stop and really think about the danger of this bill. Think of it as an experience of you're going shopping. Under the current system, a student is allowed, let's say you got a number of categories you got to fill. You got fruit, vegetable, meat. If you want to go to Byerly's to get your apples for your fruit, or if you want to get down to Rainbow and buy oranges, Byerly's can't tell you can't use oranges. You've already filled that category. But let me tell you, you put this system in place, it's a form of centralized planning. And what it's going to do is you're going to reduce the 32 campuses around the state that have little cinder block grocery stores. And when you come into the bread aisle, the only bread you'll get is Wonder Bread. When you come into the fruit aisle, if you don't like bananas, too bad, the shelves are empty except for that. So look at the implications. Now, on the other side, I feel for the young woman that ended up at Oxford. There are glitches and problems. But it has nothing to do with the general education program and the core curriculum. It has to do periodically with mismatches between major or professional programs and courses students have taken. Very clearly. It happens. But let me tell you, if you look, I just provided you. If you would spend some time tonight or tomorrow, go on this website and really look at it. The information that is available to students is phenomenal. You can't foresee and you can't guarantee that nobody's going to make a choice that doesn't fit someplace in the future. If you know roughly where you're going and the program among two or three schools, it is laid out crystal clear what you need to take and what will be accepted and what won't be accepted. So I think we get anecdotal stories, and they're true and they happen, but they are a small minority of the cases. I live in an institution, we would shrivel up and die in 6 months if these kind of problems were really massive. They aren't. But remember, the Board of Teaching is a good example. They don't say create 10 white bread teacher education programs in the state in social studies. They say we have learning outcomes and we have standards and we demand every one of you come and get approval. But we're not approving exactly the same thing. So once you get beyond the first 2 years, unless you're absolutely sure of what institution you want to go to, it does get to be very difficult. I don't want to see a single student spend a single dollar more than they have to. But on the other hand, I hope you appreciate the need for autonomy within programs. This is where creativity comes from. This is where enterprise comes from. This is the heart of good American education, just like our economy. And if you create a centralized system, what you're going to do is you're going to strangle everybody's creativity in it. And let me tell you, if you want your students only to get loaves of Wonder Bread at the cinder block school store, that's what this bill will cause.
Question, Representative, listen, Buse, when you're starving, Wonder Bread's okay, though.
It is.
You know. Question.
good with bologna, too, actually.
Sarah Zavina, I'm just wondering, you talked about a lot of the boards having standards and learning outcomes that they want for the class, for the curriculum. Do we have learning outcomes and standards for the core curriculum classes that are maybe standards throughout the Minsky?
Yes, we do. And on the back page, you can see for every one of the there's 10 goal areas. And because they're based on outcomes, each one has 5 or 6 learning outcomes. A course must meet a majority of those to be included in that category in that campus. But I could have a sociology course, and they may decide it doesn't qualify for goal 7. But a sociology course at Normandale does. If Normandale transfers to us, they fill that. But my course won't fill it. That's one of the difficulties. There might be a communications course that better fills this than my sociology course. So it's a strange mix and match. But the one positive about it is the student is absolutely guaranteed. If I take this at Austin, if I take this at Bemidji, if I take it at Fond du Lac, when I come to Metro State, they have got nothing to say about it. I have fulfilled that course. And that was the genius of the Kinkle Amendment. No longer could schools tamper with it. I do think we need, and Minshew needs to study, how can we better work the kinks out about majors? How can we do that? And I do think that needs continuous work and is a problem for a small minority of students. I have no question about that. But if you start tampering with this, what this is a seemingly simple solution that is going to cause more and worse problems in another area than you ever imagined. The unintended consequences of this bill will be horrendous.
Okay. Representative Easton, you want to come down and wrap it up or rebut anything? Or
get a little pet.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee, and I think you got a picture of the gravity of the emotion that this bill kind of brings out in with the stakeholders here. But, I mean, this isn't about apples and oranges and Wonder Bread and bananas and all that kind of stuff. This is about students. And we have a system where we invest a lot of money, a lot of state dollars, into providing opportunities for students to get higher education and get degrees so they can get into the workforce. And when we have families who are trying to pay those bills, and we have students that are committing time and effort to try and get those degrees, the more obstacles we can take out of their way, the more financial obstacles, the more obstacles to take time that we can take out of their way, the better off we are. And I'm just a little bit offended almost by the what I call almost a disingenuous kind of an attitude that somehow we should just accept the fact that these students are being required to take extra credits, more time, pay more money, and simply say our system is good enough and it's only, and I don't know if 95% is the number. The information that we get is some is anecdotal. We have some real information here tonight. But I think one of the things we should know is how big is that number? Is it 95%? Is it 75%? How big is that number? And how many students are being required to invest more time, more dollars, more of their life into a system of getting just to get their degree because our system is unwilling to respond to to the issues that could make that process more streamlined. And once again, I emphasize, we have a system here, the Minsky system. It should work as a system, and we shouldn't be pitting one school against another. We should be working for the benefit of students. And so that's the purpose of this bill, and I would encourage you to support the concept. And if we can't pass the bill, let's at least move the discussion forward.
Rep. Tenby.
Well, I'm frustrated by this discussion because I am sensitive to what the instructor was saying but I agree something has to be done so that what happened to the student doesn't happen to other students, and I guess I wish there were a better vehicle for addressing the issue, and I feel frustrated. I'm not sure how to vote on this particular legislation because I want a solution and this doesn't seem to be it.
Well, Representative Bly, I guess maybe the best vote then would be to move it along and as to for possible inclusion and come up with your own idea. Maybe that Mr. Buick can say years from now that Bly amendment was what really helped move this along.
All right.
With that, Representative Eastman. Oh, Representative Poppins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one final comment, I think. I do appreciate Representative Eastman bringing this forward because it does certainly bring forth the concerns that students have, and we need to try to do what we can to make it 100% seamless and continue to work toward that. I just wanted to clarify, I think that maybe there might be some confusion. There is a Minnesota transfer curriculum that offers within that 40 credits that a student takes, which is considered core, the 40 general education credits a student takes at the freshman and sophomore level, that is universal. That is the Minnesota transfer curriculum, that it doesn't matter what the numbering system is. It's freshman English, sociology, speech, history, math, science, it's all of those courses. And it can be that you're taking a biology class at Bemidji and you can transfer it to Riverland Community College, and maybe you'll take a chemistry class at Riverland, you're transferring it to RCTC. So that there is a 40-credit transfer curriculum that is universal. So I didn't want that to get lost in this discussion. We already have partially this system in place. If there are need to correct some other things, if students are taking electives that don't seem to fit with what their future major is, yes, we need to continue having that discussion, but I didn't want to leave Representative Easton with the impression that I don't think that we can work on some things to help make it better. That's certainly something we want to do, but I needed to say that as one final comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Easton then renews his motion that House File 3628 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the higher ed omnibus bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Motion prevails.
Division.
Division has been called for. And all those in favor of the Easton motion, raise your hand. All opposed. Motion prevails by Mr. Dawson. Representative Slocum, House File 3684. Representative Slocum moves House File 3684 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Higher Education Workforce Development Bill. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Samardzija. Representative Slocum, quick introduction, I assume.
Very quick. Although this is a hard act to follow, for sure.
You always do a good job at hard act.
Thirty-six eighty-four is requesting $1 million in funding for fiscal year 2008 and 2009 that would be leveraged with a $3 million grant from the Fed to provide healthcare training in the metro area. This would be administered through the Hennepin-Carver Workforce Investment Board, and they would be working with people to increase their skill level and allow them to have a more productive job where they had a better, more adequate wage structure. It's a way to help people climb out of low-wage jobs. I'm going to introduce my two testifiers who will talk more about exactly what the program does. I have Bill Samardzija, and I have Bruce Milk.
Members, for a point of just information, Representative Slocum had a similar bill last year that I think we gave $150,000 out of this committee, and it was vetoed by the governor. So. Mr. Samardzija.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Bill Samardzija, and I'm the lobbyist for Hennepin-Carver Working the Workforce Investment Board. And this is a very unique training program within the healthcare system. And as you said, we did have the bill passed in the Senate and the House last year, and it was vetoed. We have Bruce Knox to get into an in-depth talk about the program.
Mr. Committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight. And I want to thank you for the
work that this House did on the recent transportation bill and the infrastructure for our roads and bridges, because it reminds me that the tragic collapse of the 35W bridge might have been avoided if we invested in our infrastructure. And it reminds me that the collapse of the 35W bridge will pale in significance to what will happen if we don't invest in our infrastructure for healthcare preparation and healthcare professionals. It's not just 15 or 20 people who will lose their lives, but it's tens of thousands. A recent study, February 27th, by the Association of Public Health Service Professionals indicated that by the year 2020, which is just a very short period of time away for some of us with a few years, we're going to be facing a significant crisis in the number of professionals available for health care. And there is a train on the tracks right now. It's got 70 million baby boomers and probably 40 million uninsured individuals who need health care. And that train is moving down the track. And there is a canyon, but there's no bridge. Who will be there to take care of these people? Who will be there to take care of us? And that's really the issue. And regardless of this particular bill, whatever happens, we really need to hear that there is a need to deal with our health care infrastructure at all levels. There's an old adage, you can pay me now or you can pay me later, but you will pay me. And it's a matter of fact that we're going to be facing some critical issues. And this program that we developed a few years back was an attempt to address that. And it was an attempt to retrain incumbent workers and upgrade their skills. And once their skills were upgraded and they moved up the ladder, a slot would be opened up for somebody with less skills and less opportunity. The project involved three levels, three great sectors that are essential for any kind of workforce development. It involved employers, it involved the education system, and it involved workforce professionals coordinating this. We received $3 million from the feds, and we distributed it to the seven county metro area, and we worked with most of the large healthcare institutions in this area, Allina, Health Partners, Healthies, Park Nicollet, etc. And along with those, we worked with practically every educational institution in the state of Minnesota to retrain 527 professionals. The majority of these were nurses. And from there, we had we first intended just to serve nurses. We found, however, the need was far greater across the broad range of occupations. We ended up serving 20 different occupations, everything from lab techs to medical scientists to pharmacology majors. We worked together with employers. Employers made a significant contribution to this program. For every dollar we got from the feds, employers gave us another dollar. We had matching dollars for tuition, and the majority of the funds for the project went to tuition for individuals. And employers allowed us to work with their employees and to coordinate services and jobs for them and opportunities to get into education. The greatest barrier to our project was not unwilling workers. It was not unwilling agencies in the public. It was not unwilling employers. It was a matter of educational capacity. And that continues to be a problem. And any kind of healthcare project will involve significant levels of education, public, private, wherever. We used about 40 different educational institutions. The majority of our folks went to Minsky institutions. The rest went to private colleges in here in the state. And we used online institutions. We used whatever we could to get these folks licensed and skilled. Our outcomes were pretty successful. We had three major outcomes, which we had to report on to the feds. We had increased wages. We had whether or not an individual would get a promotion, and whether or not an individual got a degree or license from their studies. And so we had 527 people all together, 462 completed successfully. Of those 462, 427 got licensed or certified, usually an RN, LPN, et cetera. 423 obtained wage increases, 336 obtained job promotions. We took a significant, a minor portion of the funds actually to help address those who were most economically disadvantaged. We worked with Roosevelt High School. We tried to give a broad continuum from high school to post-secondary for this. And we did have a 65, what I would call unsuccessful. I'm not going to say they're failures. They made a shot at it and they couldn't do it. We worked with several clinics on the north side of the city. Many of our clients were extremely disadvantaged there, and they just couldn't compete and bring themselves up to the educational qualifications required for medical field. We think this is a good project. It's not the only project, but it is a stab at solving this issue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions of the witnesses or Representative Slocum? Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the needs are great across the state, and it's not a budget year. That's right. I'm just wondering what other programs or what other funding do you get from the state and federal for this program? Something for all you do, there must be some funding that you're getting.
Well, this project was primarily federally funded as well as employer funded. The employer contributed cash. They contributed tuition assistance for their folks.
Over the course of that years, you got $10 million from the Fed?
Yes, sir.
And then what was it matched by privately?
Again, the employers...
A dollar amount? Do you have a dollar amount that was...
It was about $1.5 million. They matched us 50% for every dollar. It was a very generous contribution. They were very excited, and they were willing to put down the money, and that says a lot.
Okay. No further questions. Representative Slocum renews her motion that House File 3684 be recommended passed and held over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. I think I'll take up my bill next. I'll take up House File 3722 that she represented Bill was getting asked. Certainly wouldn't want to keep it.
You can go ahead, Representative Ruth Vina.
Madam Chair, could I use move the delete all amendment E2? DB2.
Thank you. Representative Rukavina moves H3722DE2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Go ahead and speak to the amendment.
Madam Chair, the delete all amendment basically does a number of things. On page one, on the vacation pay, that is the plans that are administered by a union or third party, so they're not under the control of the employer and wouldn't be counted as a deduction in a weight for unemployment benefits. On the second page, what this language does, it says if you are waiting on the bench in a union building trades application for employment in your, you know, your union is looking for work for you, that counts as seeking work. And on page three, that is in there for the notification for the UI extension, which is right below there, which would be qualifying for additional UI benefits for any county that has an unemployment rate in the preceding 12 calendar months of at least 1.8 times the statewide
average unemployment rate, which would include the three counties, I believe, of Clearwater, Red Lake, and Kennebec, where there is, I think, severe unemployment when you're up at that point. And finally, the included in here on page four, members, is some language that I put in that we heard people, you know, who fell behind in their mortgage payments, some who lost their driver's license to the state because they couldn't make child support payments, and this attempts to rectify that because, you know, when a person doesn't do what's required to gain UI benefits, the state does go after them, and in this case, I think the state had a major snafu, and for those that had some real economic hardships, they should be reimbursed for it. And finally, the bill applies for an extension in Representative Dill's district, where it looks like many of the people we thought were going back to work at Ainsworth up in the Cook area will not be going back, and we don't know indefinitely how long. Representative Dill may want to comment on that, but it provides for a 26-week extension. And that's basically the delete all amendments. And council tells me I have to offer an amendment. Can I do this? Do you want to explain it, Cynthia?
Madam Chair and members, this is an amendment to the delete all amendments. If you'll turn to page, you'll turn to page 5, line 4. This is the hardship benefits, which under the draft of the bill as it is, the money would be taken from the unemployment insurance trust fund. This amendment will take the funds from the unemployment insurance program administrative funds. So the amendment will be page 5, line 4. After from, strike the. After insurance, strike trust fund, and insert program administrative funds generated by penalties imposed under Chapter 268. And then there's a typo, Madam Chair and members, on page 6, line 25. After unemployment, strike the 6 and put benefits.
Thank you for catching that. So, Madam Chair, I would move that, I guess, written amendment, by assuming, I don't know, verbal amendment, oral amendment.
Oral amendment.
But I would move that.
Okay, so Representative Rukavina moves the oral amendment. Are there any questions? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
Okay, that motion carries. Are there questions to the amended bill? Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Rokovina, how is this going to affect the unemployment trust fund? Is this going to be a quicker drain on it? Is it going to be neutral? Is it going to cause increases in the payments that the employers are going to have to pay?
Madam Chair, Representative Severson, I can't tell you the exact dollar amount, but yes, it will be certainly coming out of the trust, except for the penalty or the hardship portion of it, which will come out of the administrative cost. But the extension, as an example, for the Ainsworth provision has happened before in state law in areas where severe unemployment exists, as up in Representative Dill's district right now, and also in those three counties that I mentioned earlier. I don't know, maybe Mr. Lechtel from the AFL-CIO has an idea if there's any cost, or Mr. Nelson from the language changes on page 1 and 2. I don't know if they'd be significant. Or maybe Mr. Nelson is shaking his head, they wouldn't probably be significant. He doesn't know the dollar amount. So. Mr. Nelson, do you want to come up and comment on that? And maybe on Mr. Severson's poll question, or Representative Severson's poll question.
Mr. Nelson, you just introduce yourself to the tape, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I'm work for the unemployment insurance program as well as other divisions of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Madam Chair, Representative Peterson. Sections 1 and 2 are very minor, and the department actually fully supports sections 1 and 2. They're very minor. They may involve totals of a few tens of thousands of dollars a year. I mean, they're relatively minor. If I might go on, I'll speak to Section 7 is one part I had seen earlier. Section 7 will cost an estimated $1 million in one-time funding from the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. That's the estimate of the cost for the Ainsworth Lumber Extension. The department has no issue with Section 6 as amended, the hardship benefits. The serious question here, quite frankly, is Section 4. Section 4 is not a one-time extension. Section 4 is a change that's ongoing, so that any time any county in the last 12 months has a 1.8 times, it would trigger on. Now, it would occur, from what I understand, I've been told by staff, it would apply immediately to three counties. But this is a perpetual program. This is a change. This will continue ad infinitum. And to the extent it could add counties to it, I mean, we could figure out an estimate of what it would cost implementing it today, because we know it would apply to three counties, but what it may apply to next month may be four counties or five. We don't know what will occur and what its cost could. We could, like I said, we could give an estimate of the cost. I couldn't do it right now. I don't know how many people are unemployed collecting benefits in each of those three counties, how many are exhausting benefits. It's retroactive to January 1st. How many exhausted prior to January 1st? There are a number of things that could be looked at. We could get an estimate of that. But what its projected cost out into the future may be, we don't know. One thing, Representative Peterson, to your point and why the department has concerns, the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund is projected to go into deficit status because of the new economic forecast in the first quarter of 2010. It will go into deficit and borrow from the Federal Treasury. It will get out once first quarter receipts are received, but it is projected to go into deficit status again in the first quarter of 2011 and then again in the first quarter of 2012. It gets fairly complicated. I can explain swing loans from the Federal Treasury, but we can only do that one time, pre-interest-free. We will start paying interest on the deficit status in 2011 and in 2012. We're talking going into deficit status by hundreds of millions of dollars in 2012 before it comes out. That is the so that's why we have concerns about a program which we don't know what the cost would be. We can, like I say, we know how much Ainsworth would cost, Section 7, but Section 4, we don't know how much this would cost.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Nelson, to that point, what does the federal government charge the state of Minnesota for interest on those loans?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, that is a varying interest rate based on between short and long-term federal securities. Last I looked, it was about 6%. But it does fluctuate based on what is the balance between long and short-term federal securities.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess to that point, I appreciate Chairman Rocovina's compassion for the workers out there and wanting to increase the benefit costs. But as we're staring down the throat of a possible recession here, there are going to be other businesses that are struggling to stay online here. With increased unemployment costs, is only going to make that existence more tenuous. And looking at going down the road here in another 3 to 4 years into debt with the unemployment rate and having to pay interest on that puts even more burden on our independent businesses. So I would strongly hope that we can either modify this or vote this thing down.
But you don't have an amendment at this point regarding that?
Not at this point, Madam Chair, but I would ask Mr. Nelson to put that fiscal note together. If this makes it to the House floor, you'll see it.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Chair Rukavina.
Just the information of the committee, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Nelson, but the deficit that you talked about the UI fund being in is projected to happen regardless of whether or not Clearwater regulations can hit it just a certain week extension. And I just want members to be aware of that. And rest of the season, you know, if I had my way, I had asked Senator Bach over at the hearing with Mr. Simpson on the day after the forecast, and ask what if the unemployment extension would be a good thing for the recession, and he said it would. And so initially I want an extension for everybody that was on unemployment. But I figured you'd really raise hell with that one. So I just went to the counties that I thought were in the worst shape, and I intended to limit this, Mr. Nelson. So, you know, I just kind of put together quickly for the meeting today, a number of different items that we put together. So I would pledge to the committee that I did have a ending date on that, so it would be 6 years 1st.
Mr. Nelson appears to have a comment to make as well.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, in response to Representative Rukavina, the bill is drafted, does not have an end date to the additional benefits he provides for any county. It doesn't have a limitation to those three counties. As I say, it's a new program which will be perpetual. My guess would be, and I'll certainly get back to the committee tomorrow, as to the estimated cost. If it were limited to those three counties, with an end date, that my guess would be is relatively modest. But as I said, the difficulty with this is you can't project what will happen in the future. How expensive will this particular program be? No idea. That all depended on what unemployment rates do. I just want the committee to be aware of that. We've not seen this particular provision until the start of this hearing. I can't say what the department's position, the administration's position would be on this particular bill. There's been bandied about in Congress extensions, but it was not as part of the federal stimulus package. It was actually part of an amendment but voted down in Congress for an extension.
Alright, Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rukavina, I don't know, maybe this is a question for Representative Dill. I just wondered why the rationale for Section 7 and treating those folks differently than everybody else.
Yes, Representative Dill.
Well, Section 7 is the genesis of that is the fact that this is in a very very sparsely populated area where the community of Cook has a population of less than 600 people, and about 150, that is men, women, and children, about 150 wage earners are located at this plant that's right outside of the community. Neighboring community is about 20-25 miles away, and almost the entire community revolves around the operation of this plant. We thought 18 months ago that this plant was going to have periodic layoffs in response to the mortgage crisis and then the
continuing reduction in housing starts. The housing starts, you know, have gone down to what is almost unfathomable, and now this plant is not looking to reopen anytime in the near future. The company, which is a legitimate and ongoing company across North America, hopes to maintain their workforce and keep them in the community instead of having to, at some point in the future, having to go out and look for workers that they would have to then import back into the community, bring into this partially populated area so that their plant could run. So the idea with the unemployment benefits is beyond just trying to provide some cash flow for the families, is to maintain the workers' population base in the community so that when this super valuable part of the infrastructure and the economic fabric of the community can start up again, when housing starts to recover up somewhere into the 1 million range rather than down in the 600,000 range nationally, that we'll still have people there to do the work. And it's, as you probably can imagine, it's very difficult to get people who want to relocate to such a sparsely populated area unless it's on a temporary basis as a tourist. It's more difficult to get them to locate there permanently. So that's the genesis of this.
And if I can just add a little bit to that. In 2001, Representative Hartman, we had that major layoff at LTV in statute, I think. Maybe in rule, I don't know. But we had some criteria that then Governor Ventura said could be met. And one of them was a isolated type area, as Representative Bill called, and a, you know, kind of a massive layoff for that community. I think there were four or five different criteria that we used that time. So this is similar to that, and that extension too, if I'm not mistaken, was 26 weeks for LTV. So.
All right. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Representative Rukavina and Representative Dill. Representative Rukavina, you brought forward an amendment last session, or a bill last session, for the Ainsworth Lumber Company, I believe. Could you please give me a summary of what happened to that legislation?
Madam Chair, Representative Welty, I think we had an unemployment extension at the time, and people got called back to work, as Representative Dill stated, and now, and they thought the plant was going to reopen, but it didn't. How many people actually exercised their full extension benefit? I don't know. Mr. Nelson could maybe comment on that, but I don't know. But that's what happened. We thought they were going back to work. They did get called back to work, many of them. And then, well, the industry is so terrible that the whole plant got laid off again.
Representative Welty?
Representative Welty, I've just been corrected by Mr. Nelson. Because the other plants weren't going back in Grand Rapids and Bemidji, the extension is only extended to them. So we thought Cook was going back, and they didn't go back. I think there were some workforce development issues with that, too.
All right. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To either representative, or actually to Mr. Nelson as well, you know, in southeastern Minnesota we had the floods in August and there were several people that lost their jobs, and I know there's still a lot of economic difficulty in that region, and I'm just wondering, do we have numbers going off of the three counties that these representatives are advocating for? Do we have any numbers to show what other counties may have been impacted or might be facing some of the same numbers in unemployment due to the current recession and due to drought, due to flood, due to other circumstances that we face this year?
Yes, Representative Rukavina.
If I could, I think the next closest would be about 1.5 times the statewide average. We'll pick up a couple of more counties, if I'm not mistaken. I stepped on that, but Mr. Gelman is nodding, so maybe he knows the actual number. I think at 1.5 times we picked up a few more counties. Mr. Gelman, do you remember the exact number we picked up? It wasn't so the unemployment rate isn't that big in most other counties in the state. Correct me.
Okay, and Representative Welty.
My final follow-up question. And I guess at this point, so your criteria that Mr. Nelson, maybe you can help me with this. Under the Ventura administration, and Representative Rukavina, you alluded to this before. Under the Ventura administration, there was a set of criteria. Is that same set of criteria being used now, or could we come up with a set of criteria so that because of this current economic recession that we're in, we could put together some legislation to allow other counties or other individuals to become eligible and not have to come back with new legislation in 09. I'm looking for more of a comprehensive approach to this rather than just saying three counties. And I applaud you for advocating for the three counties that you represent, but I'm just wondering about a statewide approach to this.
Representative Rukavina.
To be perfectly clear, these counties are about as far away from my district as you can get. One is in Canada, which is just north of the cities. One is way over in Burn Leaders District, I think, and the other one, me, Red Lake, maybe Representative Deacon, I'm not sure, but they have severe unemployment, so it doesn't have anything to do with my district. As I told you, I wanted to extend an unemployment extension to everyone as a stimulus package like Congress was going to do before the chicken melts. Anyway, that's a whole other issue. But to your question about establishing something in statute, and it's been difficult, you know. There were extensions that we modeled it after Conway when there were big layoffs in Spokane. There were extensions that we modeled it after, I think National Steel had one once. But the LTV one was particularly devastating because, you know, it's at the end of the eastern end of the Iron Range. There's really nowhere and a few employees on the North Shore. So we had established some criteria, and I think we might have used part of that with Northwest Airlines, but then, of course, it didn't apply because those folks lived in the cities, and so one could argue there were always other jobs to go to. So I think it's difficult to try to establish something in law because each major layoff, whether it's, you know, a few 300 people or 150 or whatever in an isolated community like Cook, or 2,000 in a somewhat isolated area like the eastern end of the range and up the North Shore, each particular one is different, but maybe Mr. Nelson could shed some light on what we did last year regarding using some of that criteria for the Northwest and what, and maybe the answers there. Yeah.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there's been a history going back about 10, 12 years on special extensions for groups, and they've applied to various companies. Fairmont Foods down in Austin received, I think, one of the first extensions. There have been a number, EvTech, National Steel. There have been a number of ones. In 2002, the legislature did one for the airline industry and named literally 50 different companies, from SkyCap to people who did meals for airlines. Virtually every airline-related company in Minnesota had an extension. Then also for Finger Hut in St. Cloud received an extension also when that when they closed. So plant-specific extensions have been granted for a number of years. Last year there was one Ainsworth Lumber in Grand Rapids and in Bemidji. This particular one applies to Cook plants only. As far as the statewide criteria, that is actually what is done in Section 4 of the bill. Is a statewide criteria an ongoing program that's 1.8 times the state's average annual wage. So it is a criteria in law, which, you know, is a set program which would continue. Department's concern is, how do you get a handle around what it costs, how many people it would affect? We don't know. At this point, I can't give you, I just don't think it's going to be gigantic because you're talking three counties, but what it may be in the future, we don't know how many counties may fall under it.
Representative McFarland.
Yes. Madam Chair, this question is for Mr. Nelson. All of Section 6 talks about the hardship benefits due to the new system at deed last October. Can you tell me or brief us on what's happened since, and have the kinks been taken out of the system?
Mr. Nelson.
Chairman, Representative McFarland, I have the call waiting times been for the last, as you know, it's an automated system. Most people apply for unemployment benefits over the Internet. 75% of people apply over the Internet. 25% of people apply by an automated phone system, but when you do apply, you have to kick to an operator to get your name and address and a few things, or if you have an information question, you get to an operator, and there's an average wait time right now of less than a minute. I have the figures. I can pass them out. The average wait time for every day since February 1st. Mondays are always a little higher, but you know, we're looking at last Friday 41 seconds, last Thursday 56 seconds, last Wednesday 54 seconds, last Tuesday 43 seconds, last Monday 47 seconds on average wait times to kick to an operator. It has been less than that at times. One time prior Friday was 36 seconds. I can go through and list you all of them. So we think most of those problems have been solved, and most of those problems revolved around the wait time. I will admit, Representative Rukavina is correct. There were a few people. We had some data conversion problems, especially I happen to fall under his district involving some PAA benefits. I will say that there were some problems with converting data from an old system to a new system because of some of these, we call them boutique programs, and there were a few. 98% of people, no problem at all, none. It's a few people in one, but when you deal in the unemployment insurance system and you're even talking 1%, that's a big number of people. And so, yes, there were a few people who ran into some difficulties, and that's why we had a hearing on January 14th here in the evening, and there were some people, and there were a couple of testifiers that we'll have to admit who had legitimate beefs. And so that's why we take no objection to the hardship benefits. That's why I pointed out to staff how it should be funded. You cannot fund it through the UI benefits. That would probably be in violation of federal law. That's why I suggested using administrative funds obtained from penalties, which the legislature can decide how those would be spent.
Are there any other questions? And any other testifiers? No. All right. Then, I'm sorry. We do have one, and this could be Mr. Diedrich. Is that correct? Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I'll be very brief. My name is Dave Diedrich with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and many of the comments I had were already iterated by Mr. Nelson, so I have to say that the Chamber is very concerned about the current health of the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. Right now is $1 billion below what is federally recommended. Mr. Nelson told me before the committee that by the end of this month, the UI Trust Fund is going to be at about $275 million. And we are concerned not only about Section 4, like Mr. Nelson indicated, but just the precedent that is lacking in law right now about how UI benefits extensions are granted. The Chamber actually has had in our policies since the LTV case, we have advocated adopting the specific criteria that the Ventura administration used in determining whether benefits extension should increase. So we're concerned just about the precedent that is being set in here. And with that, I'll conclude my comments.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? All right. Then Representative Rukavina renews his motion that House File 3722 as amended be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Rukavina. Do you know if you want Representative Saylor next? Thank you.
Representative Taylor, welcome to the committee. Representative Mahoney moves that House Bill 2892 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Higher Education and Workforce Bill. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to bring this bill before you. Would you like me to just kind of address the bill first and then the amendments?
You need the amendments in place?
No, we could do the bill first would be fine.
Go ahead.
I'll just mention it. This bill is designed to provide some additional base resources to strengthen the existing Job Skills Partnership Program and also to modify the program requirements as we are at the beginning of what we hope will be a very short economic downturn. It certainly behooves us to look at strategic investments in Minnesota's long-term economic growth, and this bill is designed to help with that. You know, our past investments in our workforce, both K-12 and higher education, are what have carried us through many difficulties in the past. And there will be a need for quite a bit of job skills training as we face this coming dilemma. So at any rate, this bill is designed to help particularly small businesses because this bill will reduce the one-to-one business match, partner match, to a 1-to-2 for businesses with fewer than 25 employees. And this program will be, you know, is a proven program that trains thousands of workers, but we want to ensure that it works a little bit better for some of our small businesses. We know that between 99 and 2002, during the last economic slowdown, our state's smallest employers saw the largest employment growth. And we would like to see a similar situation this time. This bill requires that participating institutions also share their curriculums that they develop with the businesses, and they will share them with others in within the MinSKU system. Now, we worked with people from DEED and also from the MinSKU system in putting together language which is in the amendment. So at this time, unless there are questions on the bill, I think it would make more sense to do the amendment since that makes a significant change.
Okay, Representative Mahoney.
I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Very good. Representative Mahoney is moving H2892A1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. Motion prevails. And to the amended bill, more comments?
Thank you.
Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will just briefly mention what this amendment does. It puts in some language that was suggested by both DEED and by MinSKU to address some concerns that they had with regard to dissemination of information throughout the system. And a lot of it is just simply then, you know, the page one, page two, connecting, or rather addressing some of the changes made earlier. And then further, there are some deletions of, like, section four, the entire piece is being deleted, and also section six. Since we made some changes earlier on in the bill, we did not need those sections. So at this point, I don't know if there are questions to the amendment, but I do also have a testifier from the MinSKU system that would be available to answer any questions if anyone had any with regard to that.
How about if the testifier goes ahead and states his name and then goes ahead with testimony?
My name is Richard Tweeden. I am the System Director for Customized Training and Continuing Education in the Office of the Chancellor. And thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I just want to comment on one issue that the amendment has taken care of, and that is our system, the MinSKU system, is the primary recipient of most of these grants. We earn somewhere between 80 and 90% of the grant dollars on a regular basis. one of the things we've been working on quite vigorously lately is to get all of our institutions to begin to share the results of the curriculum so that we don't have duplication of effort, and so that more and more of our businesses get the benefit from the curriculum. The amendment promotes that right now, and our system is very satisfied with it. We're also satisfied with the suggestion that the program needs additional funds, and we're also satisfied with the fact that the HELP loan program is being recommended to be closed because it has not been used. And I sit on the MJSP board as Pastor James McCormick's designee, so I'm pretty familiar with the MJSP program. And that's all.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions? Is there anyone else who wanted to testify in opposition or in support? All right. Then I would say Representative Mahoney renews his motion that House File 2892 as amended be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. Motion failed. Thank you, Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Biskin. Representative Severson will move House File 43. It will be laid over for possible inclusion.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Severson. Welcome, Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. On my hearing request form, I put down that I would take 10 minutes. That wasn't a scam to get the chair to hear the bill. I will keep to that 10 minutes. Members, a big issue in our economy today, of course, one we've heard over and over and over again, is the mortgage crisis that we're facing, and a lot of people are facing that mortgage crisis due to the fact that they took out very risky variable rate mortgages. Right? Members, I contend that in probably the second biggest investment that Americans make, that of their college program and their college degree, all we have to give those people is variable rate mortgages on their education. And what this bill is an attempt to put in another option when it comes to financing a college education. As this bill came about, as I have children who are moving from high school into college, and in a small town, of course, you have a whole group of folks that have been together at the ball games as the kids go through. And we got to talking last year as there was a big issue when it came to the escalating tuition rates. There were proposals here in the legislature to throw a whole boatload of money into the system and see if we can't buy down tuition rates. On my side of the aisle, there was a proposal to actually freeze tuition rates for 1 year. Personally, one I opposed because, of course, the minute you take off the freeze, it's going to jack right up, all right? But I was talking to one of my neighbors who came up with the idea. He said, well, why don't we just, whatever the rate may be, it may be. Right? The problem for families, though, is we can't budget. Because of the changes year to year, we simply can't create a budget. We can't lay out, here's what it's going to cost, let's plan on how we're going to pay that cost both now and if we have to take out loans into the future. And so that's how this bill came about. What this bill simply does is it says, right now we give broad latitude to both the Minsky system and the University of Minnesota to set its tuition rates. This bill does not change that one iota. What this bill does is it adds a second component into law. It doesn't delete anything from law. It doesn't take away any powers that Minsky or the University of Minnesota has. It just simply puts another piece into law which says you have to also offer a fixed rate plan, a guaranteed plan for the 4 years of college. Now, it's written very specifically that when a student comes in, the clock starts ticking, and that fixed rate plan lasts for 4 years. And if a student lollygags and goes into a fifth or sixth year, then the fifth and subsequent years kicks up to whatever the new rate is at that time. All right? So the bill has a couple of reasons to support it. First is that it allows families and students to plan and to budget. The bill also has a benefit that it allows families and students to compare costs from school to school to school at a stable comparison. Right? Of course, they compare in year one, right, and look at, all right, what's the tuition now, but they can't compare throughout the entire degree earning time frame. The third thing that it has in here, which I think is very beneficial to us as state lawmakers, is that within this law, because of the adjustment after the fourth year, it does indeed have a built-in incentive for students to take their college time seriously, to crack the books, not to, I don't want to say horse around, but I'll say horse around, all right, and get their degree done in 4 years. So I know that's something that's important to us as legislators. All right. Fifth component for supporting this bill is that, as I said at the very beginning, all right, this will teach young adults from basic economics, about the difference between a fixed rate and a variable rate, and it'll be that prior to them taking out a $250,000 mortgage on a home, when the results could obviously be much more detrimental. Mr. Chair, I could bring up a fleet of testifiers, but I think the bill speaks for itself. When I put it out there, I've heard from students and families throughout the state. However, it's not that complicated of an issue, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before this committee. I voted for your amendment, by the way, on the floor today. And members, I will stand for questions.
After you made me cut it in half. Representative Greiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Biskins, I'm wondering if you're aware of any other states that have this type of program in place.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brainerd, I don't have the state deal. I had done research on this last year, and I didn't gather it before, but I do know there are a couple, and I can get that to you. I do know that the University of Minnesota used to offer this. All right, outside of state law. However, it wasn't widely used back when they offered it. But I will also argue back when they previously offered it, we weren't seeing the incredible escalations in tuition costs that we're seeing now. And so I think it might be time to resurrect this plan for students and families.
Representative Bryant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Biskins, the reason I'm asking is your idea intrigues me, but what I'm curious about is what kind of formula we see operating. Once you put that rate in place and you have students guaranteed for 4 years, how does that affect the incoming freshman class, and do they see what kind of rate increase do they see in comparison if the burden for whatever inflationary factors the university is seeing. Eventually, I can see it would level off, but I'm kind of wondering how that formula would work and would be distributed.
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Brainerd. I think one of the beauties of this bill is it doesn't micromanage that. Right? And if anybody can figure out how to do this and do this well, I would think it'd be an institution of higher learning.
But Representative Biskins, I think maybe one of the reasons why the it wasn't used at the university is because, you know, and I'm, like I always claim to be, the world's worst capitalist, but in the words of my old neighbor, Ivan Matasic, used to say, nothing for nothing. And, you know, somebody's got to pay. So the question is, who pays when you lock somebody in? Is it the following freshman class, or is it the student themselves? Because the tuition is jacked up in recognition, which I think might be the way the university did it. It was a little higher at the time, and it locked them in. So basically, I commend you for the idea, because it's a capitalistic commodities type, you know, it's like putting in the commodities market. So, you know, but somebody's going to pay eventually.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and of course that you know, is all part of the fixed rate versus variable rate gamble, for lack of a better word. All right, yeah, one would assume that right out of the chute, the fixed rate is going to be higher than the variable rate, but you know, there is a potential that at the end of 4 years, that fixed rate is still higher than the variable rate. If the economy boosts, if the state is flush with revenue because of a thriving business economy, if the legislature pumps a lot more capital into the system, then maybe tuition rates don't increase in the way we've seen it increase in the past decade. All right? And that's part of, you know, that whole decision-making process that families will go through. Do you want the security of a fixed rate over time, knowing the potential reasonably exists that fixed rate stays above the variable rate for the entire 4 years? Or do you want to take the gamble and take the lower rate with the potential that after just simply a year, the lower rate's above the fixed rate? But the families get to choose, and that's the beauty. That's the capitalism in this.
Finally, you're pro-choice. Any other questions, Representative Biskins? Does anybody want to speak against this in the audience? Does anybody want to speak for it in the audience? Okay, it's not been Representative
Poppin.
Representative Severson renews his motion that House Bill 43 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
I don't know. Motion prevails. And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll give you a little.
Representative
Mahoney.
House
3782.
With
yours costs money. All those in favor signify by saying aye. House file, Representative Mahoney moves House file 3782 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus higher education workforce development bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that is my motion. House File 3782 creates an Office of Science and Technology with Indeed to strengthen the support for technology-based industries in Minnesota. The primary purpose is to connect and small and medium-sized businesses with federal grants, research dollars, and contracts. In addition, the office will be a leader in assisting to assist emerging technology companies with licensing, intellectual property, and commercialization. Right now, Minnesota is in the catch-up phase compared to other states that are investing in entrepreneurial companies whose focus is our research and development and leading to commercialization. There is a direct correlation in how states support R&D and commercialization and the numbers of federal contracts they receive. Only 27 cents on the dollar that we send to Washington comes back to us as R&D for these type of grants. Minnesota in 2004 ranked 34th in defense spending. 14th in National Health, the National Institute of Health, and the Small Business Technology Transfer, 22nd. As recently as 2005, when we were 34th in the defense share of defense spending, just 10 years earlier we had been number 22. The Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota, which was reported to my committee, states that Minnesota lags in the commercialization of R&D in the life sciences and Minnesota's startup businesses. The University of Minnesota reported that it's dropped from 2nd to 9th among the 14th leading research institutions during the 90s. Much of this is because we're not getting the research grants and commercialization grants we should out of the federal government. These are jobs that pay on average about $65,000 a year. These are really very, very good jobs. For every dollar that we get from the federal government in this particular fashion, we generate about $9 more in private investment. Earlier today, we had quite a long discussion about a $25,000 grant or loan. In Ohio, they have a program called the Third Frontier Program, 10-year plan to invest $1.6 billion. And with this, these federal grants and private funding brings in another $6 billion worth of R&D in Ohio. Massachusetts just passed a $1.6 billion program. Virginia is the largest, gets the least, the most number of contracts from federal government. Now, granted, they're right next door to Washington, D.C.
I thought you were talking about my Virginia for a minute.
Sometimes, Mr. Chairman, we wish you were right next to D.C. But Jim's a good guy right now anyhow, so we won't go down that road. They get approximately $14 million in these contracts for R&D and commercialization. $14 billion. And you times that by 9, that's an awful lot of dollars. Minnesota is woefully inadequate in getting these kind of dollars. It's very, very frustrating to me. I could go on with many, many things. I've brought a testifier here that has gone through the process and created a very successful business. But it wasn't, I won't say it wasn't easy. I'll just let him tell you how his experience was in getting SBIR grants and what he managed to create with that. And maybe he might also tell for this committee some of the offers he's gotten from other states, aside from what the testimony is in this particular bill. And I'd like to, if you'd just introduce yourself to the committee.
Sure. Just hold on one second. Are you Mr. Marusic?
Yes.
Okay. Just hold on, because before I forget the minutes, which I did last week, Representative Ruth moves to approve the minutes of the March 4th meeting. Are there any additions or corrections? Thank you, Representative Ruth. If not, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Haas moves the minutes of the March 5th meeting. I'm sure he's read them.
They're wonderful minutes.
Any additions or corrections? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Motion is adopted. Mr. Marusic.
Thank you, Chairman Rukavina, members. My name is Kerry Marusic. I'm the founder, president, and CEO of Third Wave Systems. And I'm here tonight not only to tell you our story about our business and how successful we have been and the hard days as well, but also to really emphasize 2 points tonight relating to this bill, being that we do a significant amount of business outside of the state. One, I believe it's really important from a technology standpoint to have a focal point within the state to help with these small business innovative research and other types of research contracts. If you look at the percentage as Representative Mahoney just highlighted of funds that are going to this state compared to other states which do not have the high-tech reputation of Minnesota, it's pretty anemic. The second point I'd like to make is that we're competing with other states. And for example, I got contacted here several weeks ago from Kentucky, of all places. There's a science and technology park that's at the Cincinnati Airport, in Lexington, Kentucky right now, and they're looking for companies to locate there, and their state will match dollar for dollar Small Business Innovative Research, or SBIR, contract. So it's getting real competitive out there for bringing tech companies into a lot of states. So those are the two points I'd like to make. Who we are. Third Wave Systems develops and sells virtual prototyping software for aerospace and defense companies, automotive companies, and now we're branching out into semiconductor and optics organizations. We're basically about 30 or so engineers, mostly master's and PhD level engineers, and we're a bunch of guys, or people I should say, all our engineers are guys, that are into making cars, airplanes, and into computers. With this technology, our customers, who are companies like Boeing, Lockheed Martin, General Motors, Ford, Airbus, Toyota, and so on, can make their products lighter, cheaper, and at lower cost. We've been growing pretty consistently now at about 35% a year for 10 years, and now have we'll do just under $10 million in revenues this year. We'll probably break 10 next year. Our office is, this is home. We don't do any business in Minnesota. We just live here. And we've also got a small office in Detroit, Hartford, Connecticut, England, and let me think for a minute. Oh, and a small one in Japan as well. Can't forget Japan. Basically, our startup story is about 10 years ago, well, 12 years ago now. We started the company, myself and my brother. We had no money. We had no customers. We had basically some pretty cool technology, and that was about it. I tried to go to venture capitalists to raise money. They didn't understand what the hell we did. It's new technology. They didn't want to take a risk. At that point, somebody told us in Ohio to go after some small business innovative research funding to bring the technology along. We did that. We were successful with the Air Force. We had some proved we proved the technology using SBIR funding, and just like that, I was able to obtain some private financing from a number of friends and family, and at the same time we got significant contracts from companies like Boeing in the early days, Boeing, General Motors, and Ford. It wasn't easy at that time. I didn't know what SBIR was. And the people that we were working with at the time were instrumental in really teaching us the process. And I just think that when looking at other states now, as well as what we've gone through, and in the early days, I mean, it was extremely tenuous. We didn't know how we were going to make payroll. I mean, it's your classic high-tech startup story. But I'm just really grateful at the time that we had the SBIR funding and were able to work with some really wonderful people, because literally we would have been bankrupt years ago if it were not for the SBIR. Let's see, just a couple other points here. I did mention it's extremely competitive. The markets we play in, we're getting actively recruited right now to build our R&D in Michigan. We have a small office there, and we do a significant amount of automotive business. Seattle, the Seattle area with Boeing, I mean, they're getting aggressive as well. But I just think that, you know, if we're going to be the technology state that we have been in years past, it's important to foster that, and I think this is a great way to do it.
Okay, questions. Well, Representative Mahoney or Mr. Marusic, I guess Mr. Marusic, you know, the University of Minnesota does almost all the basic research in the state of Minnesota, which is kind of atypical in the United States. But you were able to go after these just by the luck of the draw. You heard about it, and now you're getting...
Well, we were encouraged from some people that we met down in Ohio originally, and I would argue that any real technology usually starts in the Department of Defense. Our business model is, if you look at through the history of all kinds of different technologies, they always start in the DOD. Semiconductors started there. Even if you look at some of the current research that's being done on medical devices and early stage cancer drugs, a lot of that stuff is even done within the DOD. And the hardest part is taking that basic research and really turning it into something that'll really create jobs and money.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Hoy.
My witness is correct. One of the new technologies that's coming out is delivering morphine or pain drugs directly to the womb. And that's being developed in the Department of Defense because of the Iraq War. But it's also being looked at as how you can use it in medical operating rooms so that patients have less recovery time or less opportunity to become dependent on drugs. And I can go down the list time and time again. What my witness, and I'm not from Croatia, so I have a hard time with his last name.
Marusic.
Marusic. Perfect. didn't speak to is the number of times the SBIR and the Phase 2 SBIR grants that he got. They're very competitive, and he got more than once. One of the problems with the state of Minnesota and DEED is that DEED has this program going. It's one of the four or five things in this person's portfolio. This person is doing four or five or six other things and this. And this is a thing, this is a program that can do technology, that can bring serious amounts of technology, commercialization technology. The university is a wonderful place to do basic research. But they don't commercialize very well. They're working on it, but they don't do it very well. The 400 or 500 technology companies in this state are the ones that take basic research and make jobs with it. A company like Third Wave. Mr. Chair, this $400,000 creates a small department within DEED. We almost had it last year, but the governor told us that he'd veto that particular piece in the bill. This is an important part to the future of Minnesota if we're trying to create jobs that pay a lot of money and provide a lot of benefits for the state.
Well, thank you, Representative Mahoney, for reminding the committee that you did get this funded in last year's bill, and then I couldn't remember what happened because, you know, the bill got split up and you went one way and I was on that conference committee, but I was running between higher education. So I don't really know. So refresh our memory. Did the governor say, I know he said he vetoed the bill if it was in there. Did he say why?
The office of DEED came to my office and told me that they were going to create this office themselves within their portfolio of employees. And when I said, I didn't word it correctly by saying, well, I expect it to be an office with three or four people. I said, well, I expect I'll be watching to see what this office is. And this office was created as part of a portfolio of one person that does three or four other things. This person is amazing to get what we do get. But it is, there are 100 other third waves out there waiting to be started. And that's 3,000 jobs that pay a lot of money. But we are missing that particular boat. And the governor indicated that needed to come out of the bill.
And do you know, I see the deed is still here, but do you know if the commissioner or the governor support it this year?
Well, Mr. Chair, the governor has seen the error of his ways, and his seed program has a similar program in his seed program this year. Now, my bill last year was much more specific. I'm just trying to get this program moving forward. And I'd like to hold it over for possible inclusion in any kind of an omnibus bill that you might do.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Rukavina, and to, well, I have a couple questions, and either of you can answer those questions. And the first one is essentially looking at this, many constituents, or I should say a handful of constituents, have contacted me and they want to start up a new business. So I refer them to the Small Business Development Center. And a lot of the people down in my area have never heard of that before. They don't know where it's located. And so the one question I have is, if we create another office, are we just creating more bureaucracy and we won't really get the information out to the people in Minnesota that we need to get it to? And this kind of goes to the testifier. Are people calling into Deed? Are people requesting this information and just not getting it? Or do we need another position to get this information out to possible startup companies throughout the state? I'm just trying to figure out how we use our dollars wisely.
My background, again, is purely on the high-tech side of things, and I can tell you from experience, we learned fairly early on, thank goodness, that there was this SBIR opportunity out there. And I think that it's just a matter of technology. People are going to be aware of the program and then naturally look for help. That would be my experience.
Mr. Chair and President Welty, the small business offices are not really trained to do SBIR kind of equipment. They would be applications. They would be, the SBIR would be referred from a small business office, from the initiative groups where they are doing, more locally they know who they are dealing with and who's doing the manufacturing. Maybe even in a, there's any number of different ways, but they would be referred to this particular program rather than having it advertised in the billboard as you go down to 52.
Okay. Other questions? Well, Representative Mahoney, I would say that, you know, the governor and Commissioner McElroy certainly are flattering you with their imitation of your program, because they're asking for 400 in the base for their new Assist Entrepreneur SBIR. So,
no, the governor evidently they write once a year.
They listen to you, and the governor does have about $3 or $4 million of new money in our division here, maybe a little more than that, but some of it's for the Job Z program. So that might be hard to feel, but you know, the rest of it we could easily look at. Anyway, Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mahoney, and to the testifier. I think this is a great initiative. We came to Minnesota and got involved in a high-tech company and started through this process a little with SBIR. But one of the things I wanted to talk about was the second career military retired pay exemption, which I'm going to plug right here, because you heard some of the testimony in the Virginia model where they have $14 billion coming from federal contracts, and that is specifically because you have retirees jumping out of the beltway from the DOD and then staying in that area and then funneling that money into the business sector. And so what we've done in Minnesota is we've basically put this wall up and said, we're not interested in you, because we are one of six states that actually tax your pension. Where Virginia has grabbed down to the other side and said, you know what, if you want to work here, we've got the place for you. So I just say that, because too often we look at the Department of Defense as making bullets and guns, when just the things that the Representative Mahoney was talking about, there's a tremendous amount of market sector out there in the medical and all of the other DOD categories that we are not capturing as a state, because we have held up this barrier. So I would hope that we can continue on with this type of venue and try and encourage those people that are getting out of the military particularly to come here. The other is the veteran-owned businesses, a targeted group, because they have access that other normal businesses don't to federal contracts, and they have the ability to target those and bring those monies to the state without the competition that normally goes with it. So just a plug. Mr. Chair, I appreciate your time, your indulgence.
Thank you.
We've got to take advantage where we can, correct?
Representative Severson, I think Mr. Marusic brought up a good point that a lot of what we do have in technology came from the, you know, Department of Defense. In fact, one of my friends was a pilot, a helicopter pilot in Nam, and one of those little gunner helicopters, whatever they were. And he said, you know, when first those virtual reality things came out, he said, I think we had those, we were wearing those in the back when we were gunning, you know, back in 1968 or whenever it was. But, you know, I think the program is a good idea as far as your comments on the tax exemption. In case you haven't noticed what's being cut and proposed to be cut by the governor, everything from, you know, cost of living for folks in long-term cares that were mentally and medically handicapped people live in that. You know, I have no problem with the exemption. I'd like it to be maybe somewhat means-tested, but that's another point. But you can't get things unless you pay for them somehow. So everybody else has to pay, because if you don't do it, what's like Governor Pawlenty is proposing, then somebody else got to take the hit. That's the only concern I have with that whole tax exemption for military retirees.
Back to my bill.
Back to your bill, which is what he was promoting it on. Well, Representative Mahoney renews his motion then that House File 3782 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion. Before we vote on this, Mr. Marusic, are you a Croat or a Serb? No, I'm just kidding. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign, motion prevails. Members, with that, then, I'm not going to take my bill up tonight because I thought this was going to take longer. We're right on time for adjourning. We'll take that other little unemployment bill up at a later date. Meeting adjourned.